Yeah, I can finally live life again properly.
It changed my life. Yeah, it do change my life.
The Radio 4 Christmas Appeal, making a difference. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this morning at 9:45.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 7th of December. This is Tina Ritchie. Good morning. Thousands of guaranteed jobs in sectors such as construction and hospitality are to be offered to young people on benefits as part of an £800 million government package to tackle rising youth unemployment. The measure will also offer training and job interviews to try to shift claimants into work. Our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
There are almost a million young people in the UK who are not in education, employment or training. This funding, the government says, will mean 350,000 on universal credit will get training and exposure to work in construction, hospitality and health and social care. Others will get intensive support to help them find jobs. And starting in the spring, 55,000 government-backed guaranteed jobs will start to be made available. The Work and Pension Secretary, Pat McFadden, described it as an attempt to create real pathways into good jobs. The Conservatives said tax rises implemented by the Chancellor were driving up youth unemployment.
At least 25 people have been killed and around 50 injured in a fire at a nightclub in the Indian state of Goa. The majority of victims are thought to be staff at the club's kitchen. Tourists are among the dead. The fire is believed to have been triggered by an exploding gas cylinder. West Midlands Police says one of its senior officers never intended to imply that members of the Jewish community supported the banning of fans from the Israeli club Maccabi Tel Aviv from a match against Aston Villa. The decision not to allow Israeli supporters to attend the Europa League game last month sparked a political row. Our political correspondent Ian Watson has more details.
Senior police officers from the West Midlands faced questioning from the Cross-Party Home Affairs Committee last Monday about their role in the controversial decision to ban away supporters on safety grounds. Ultimately, Maccabi Tel Aviv didn't take up its ticket allocation. The Assistant Chief Constable, Mike O'Hara, said there were a range of faiths, backgrounds and ethnicities that were very concerned about the fixture. When he was asked by the chair of the committee, Karen Bradley, if that included Jewish people, he said yes, and that this had been documented in a community impact assessment. But the force has now said that in answering these questions, it was never the intention to imply that there were members of the local Jewish community who backed the fans' exclusion.
The US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth has described American attacks on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Pacific and the Caribbean as righteous, and he likened drug smugglers to terrorists. Mr. Hegseth has faced criticism for the way the airstrikes have been carried out, but he told defence industry leaders in California the world was seeing America's strength of resolve to stop the drug gangs.
We are tracking them, we are killing them, and we will keep killing them so long as they are poisoning our people with narcotics so lethal that they're tantamount to chemical weapons.
Voting is taking place for elections in Hong Kong, where there's anger about one of the deadliest fires in the city in decades. Some pro-democracy politicians have been jailed, while others have fled the territory since China introduced a sweeping security law 5 years ago. From Hong Kong, Danny Vincent reports.
This is only the second Legislative Council election since the system was overhauled in 2021 by the authorities. Under the rules, only people deemed patriots are allowed to stand and candidates are vetted. Critics say Hong Kong has suffered an erosion of freedoms since a wide-ranging national security law was introduced in 2020. The poll is taking place 11 days after a fire at a block of flats killed 159 people, prompting questions about how the blaze spread so quickly and some public anger. The vote is being seen by many as a test of confidence in the authorities, with the turnout likely to come under particular scrutiny.
The Foreign Office is urging football fans heading to next summer's World Cup in the US, Mexico and Canada to be on the lookout for scammers selling fake tickets. The warning came after England and Scotland learned details of their opening fixtures, with Wales and Northern Ireland still hoping to book places through the playoffs. Here's Simon Jones.
The organisers, FIFA, say almost 2 million World Cup tickets have already been sold, with the next batch about to be made available. But they don't come cheap. Tickets for the final cost up to £4,500. The Foreign Office is warning England fans heading to Dallas and Scotland supporters planning a trip to Boston for their first games to buy tickets only from the official website. Those sold on unofficial resale websites or on social media may not be genuine, potentially leaving fans out of pocket a long way from home.
Cricket. England are trying to avoid going 2-0 down in the Ashes on the fourth day of the Brisbane Test. At tee, the visitors had reached 193 for 6 in their second innings, leading Australia's first innings total by 16 runs. BBC News.
I'm Katie Wazell, the BBC's culture editor, and this is the story of a book.
It's a wonderful book. She's an immensely talented and immensely valuable writer.
Award-winning, commercially and critically successful. Then cancelled.
It just infuriates me. You're reinforcing stereotypes.
I remember feeling sick by page 8, maybe.
A culture war about race, class, and who has the right to say what.
I do not think that I wrote in any way a racist book.
6 episodes considering different perspectives. Anatomy of a Cancellation from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 4. Good morning. You might not associate a cattle ranch in the American Midwest with the frontiers of conservation, but one farmer has been doing his bit among the scorching heat and wildfires of South Dakota, as Anna Jones will be finding out in On Your Farm in half an hour. Before that, Beyond Belief asks why a French Catholic thinker is having an influence on Silicon Valley and US politics. The programme starts at Stanford University almost 20 years ago.
I have a guest with me in the studio who has spent the greater part of his career trying to understand the fundamental mechanisms of human desire. His name is René Girard, and it's a distinct privilege and honour to have him on this programme. René, welcome.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Professor Girard is one of the titans of 20th century thought, and I, for one, believe that the 21st century will vindicate the cogency of his theories in a clamorous way.
Welcome to Beyond Belief. My name is Giles Fraser. That was an interview from the campus radio station of Stanford University in San Francisco back in 2007. And those words of the presenter seem to be coming true. Now, a decade after his death, René Girard, a man who defies definition, part literary critic, part social theorist, part theologian, is getting name-dropped everywhere. And it's largely down to a certain set of recent devotees spreading the message far and wide, tech entrepreneurs led by the billionaire former student of Girard's, Peter Thiel. They've latched onto one aspect of Girard's big, compelling theory, an idea so simple a child can understand it, and once it's been explained, you can see it everywhere. It explains why, even though I have a house stuffed full of toys, my children always choose to play with and then fight over the same one.
Mimetic desire is fundamentally a desire in which the choice of the object the individual is going to desire is not determined by that object itself, as we normally believe, but by a third person. We imitate a third person, and this is what mimetic means.
In other words, we desire things through the eyes of others. Desire is a form of mimesis, which is a fancy academic word for copying. This is the first bit of René Girard's theory, and it's currently getting all the airtime with the tech bros. But there are other important elements, including a strong Christian message that some of the more theologically minded keepers of Girard's flame worry is getting left out or distorted. I have 3 guests with me today to give you a Girard 101. Cynthia Haven was a friend of Girard's. She was his biographer and an editor of his writings, and she's joining us from America. Welcome.
Hello, Giles.
Father Michael Kerwin is a Jesuit priest. He's the Associate Professor of Theology at Trinity College Dublin and a longtime scholar of Girard's work. Welcome, Father.
Giles, great to be with you. Thank you.
And finally, the philosopher Alexander Douglas. He's the senior lecturer at the University of St Andrews, who's written a new book, Against Identity, The Wisdom of Escaping the Self, which includes quite a lot of stuff on Girard. Alexander, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
Could you explain to me how this whole thing about mimetic desire works?
Mimetic desire is a desire that we acquire from a model, that we see somebody else wanting something and we come to want it ourselves. Girard thought that other than very basic appetites, this is where all our desires come from. And he thought that because he says we have this kind of urge for being, which I interpret to mean an urge for a kind of identity. We want to be something distinct. We want to be someone in particular. But we don't know at the start who that someone is. We don't, you know, you can't look inside and see who you truly are because we're still being formed. So you can only look to others.
It's almost like a basic principle of advertising, isn't it? I mean, you know, you might want Michael Jordan sneakers, not because of any intrinsic quality to the sneakers, but because they're Michael Jordan sneakers.
Yeah, in fact, advertising changed, I think, as advertisers realised. You know, advertisements in the sort of 1950s were more like rational arguments about why you should buy some product, listing the virtues of the product. More and more, they shifted to just an image of somebody admirable enjoying the product. And it doesn't even matter what the virtues of the product are. You know, you just see that someone like Michael Jordan or whoever your hero is uses this product.
Yeah, it's a classic instance of mimetic desire.
But the secret is to sell you these products and yet still convince you that you are an autonomous agent.
Yes.
That you are making a free decision. And I think that's where the alternative is what Girard calls the romantic lie. The notion that we are autonomous, that we are free, independent individuals in charge of our destiny the whole time. He's challenging that by recognizing, no, we are way, way more dependent on one another than you might think.
I mean, I've read all this stuff many times and I love it. And I sort of understand what Girard's going on about. But I'm still entirely susceptible to all this mimetic stuff, very suggestible to it.
You can't not be.
You can't not be.
Ultimately, we want stuff because we want to be someone else and we want to occupy someone else. And that's where all the trouble begins. That's what begins the mimesis and all of that, is this desire to be not us, to be someone else, to have the being of someone else.
I mean, this all stuff rings true really in the playground, doesn't it? When you can see people whose identity is yet to be formed and are sort of seeking their identity, and they seek their identity from pulling it from others around them. That's the sort of thing that you find really important, Alexander, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, this passage that Cynthia has pulled out, Girard says at one point in his earliest book, he says that the other seems to have this fullness of being that I don't have. And the reason for that is because, you know, you're aware of all your own insecurities. You're aware of the fact that you could change all the things you're doing at any time. You're constantly thinking about whether you want to. And you look at these other people and they just seem fully formed because you don't see all the inner turmoil in them. So, yeah, the playground, or you can think back to your teenage years, you know, everybody seemed to already have their thing that they were into. Of course, they're all in the same position, but you don't see it. So the other becomes this almost mythical figure. He has a chapter called Men Become Gods in the Eyes of Each Other, you know, has a sort of godlike completeness of being that you don't have. We don't necessarily feel all of this consciously, but it kind of happens in us. And then we find ourselves copying the desires, the behaviors, the speech patterns, the dress sense of these models, purely because they seem to have being, which we lack.
Girard talks that this is a kind of secret. He says all the other great sins that are rehabilitated. So you can be lustful, you can be greedy and so on, but being envious is still seen as something shameful. Yeah. So the last sin to still be taboo in a way.
To see one's own inner nakedness is the thing that we're trying desperately to hide.
Yeah,
or inner nothingness, that we're ashamed of our inner nothingness, and we try to borrow our identity from others, to copy it, and to fill ourselves up with that. Alexander, why is Girard having a bit of a moment?
Well, the less interesting, philosophically interesting answer is just that he, as you mentioned, has been promoted by a very powerful and wealthy promoter, which is Peter Thiel. But I think that Girard, you know, and this certainly had nothing to do with my interest in Girard, and I don't think the interest that our other two guests have had either, because there's something very zeitgeisty about Girard. He picks up on a feature of human desire that becomes so incredibly visible once we have the sort of social media technologies that we have today. But of course, he was writing about this long before those sorts of tools made it so visible and apparent. So I think that that's at least part of the the story.
The mimetic stuff really lends itself to sort of social media, doesn't it, with the likes and the way in which people reflect back to each other what they've been saying.
Likes, retweets, memes, you know, all of these are just sort of such obviously mimetic phenomena that, yeah, I think.
Cynthia, you were his biographer. You knew him at Stanford, where he was a lecturer. What do you make of this newfound fame?
It's spreading mimetically.
Yes, it is. So,
kind of a snowball effect.
Give us a bit of a picture of him. I met him a few times. He was a sort of like, he reminded me of a sort of very sort of distinguished French gentleman. He was an extraordinary figure, wasn't he?
He was. And I know few people who have been as much fun to talk to as he was.
Yeah.
He was gentle, kind, intelligent, fun, humorous. Being with him was always a pleasure.
Yeah. How did he come up with this very simple idea of mimetic desire?
Yes, he began as a literary critic. After he graduated from the École des Chartes in Paris, he had an opportunity to come to America, and he came to the University of Indiana, and he was assigned to teach French literature. He had never taught a day in his life, so this was absolutely new for him. He moved on, his ideas expanded, and as he read these novels that he was teaching, Dostoevsky, Flaubert, a few others, he began to see patterns in the novels. He began writing about it, and it became the mimetic theory.
The next stage of this story that he tells, this whole idea that what we want is copied, ends up issuing in conflict.
Exactly, yes. There's an instability about our desires. They're very volatile, and that can lead to violence and rivalry. And the second phase then is about how that gets resolved by social groups ganging up on what you'd call a scapegoat, a victim, a marginal figure or a group that you project your anger and frustration on.
We've spoken a bit now about mimetic desire and rivalry and violence that ensues from it. So let's just move on to this next bit of Girard's big theory.
There are signs that archaic communities, but even modern communities, all communities, are subject to disturbances which tend to spread to the entire community contagiously through a form of mimetic desire. If you have two people who desire the same thing, you will soon have three. When you have three, they contaminate the rest of the community faster and faster. Therefore, you're going to have a disturbance of that entire community. And as they become contaminated with mimetic desire, the differences which separate them collapse. And therefore, you go toward what I call a mimetic crisis. A mimetic crisis is the moment when everybody at the same time is fighting over something, the same object. And as that conflict grows, it threatens to destroy the whole community. What happens to end that sort of crisis? And my answer to this is that at some point, there is a contamination on a victim, one particular victim. One particular victim seems to more and more people to be responsible for the whole trouble. In other words, the mimetic contagion moves from desire to a specific victim. Everybody is going to become hostile to that victim. The lynching of a victim, of a single victim, will cause the community to be reconciled against that victim. There is the quote-unquote scapegoat of that community.
This is a really interesting theory. The idea that you have this mimetic desire, which issues in rivalry, rivalry issues in conflict and violence, and then this violence is sort of expunged through the community, alighting upon us almost at random, upon a sort of scapegoat, and this cleanses, as it were, the community of violence. Michael, the way that you tell a story like this, it seems like religion's a bad thing. Religion is sort of endorsing this scapegoating of often innocent people and this sacrifice and all of this sort of stuff. This seems to be a sort of horror story rather than something to be celebrated.
It does indeed. And when Girard first put these ideas out there, and in particular he was talking about sacrifice and religious practices like sacrifice, myths and rituals, these are ways of covering up and dealing with violence in contexts, in cultures that had no other way. There wasn't an army, there wasn't a police force and so on. So this is the way in which violence is contained.
So religion is an alibi for the sort of the scapegoat mechanism which rids the community of violence.
Religion contains violence in both senses. It controls it, but it also does it by being violent itself. And when these ideas came out, great book in 1972, Violence and the Sacred, a lot of people thought this was an atheist criticism of religion, that he was putting a nail in the coffin saying, right, this is what religion is. It's just a way in which societies deal with their violence. So, yes, as it came across, religion is seen as a kind of, not necessarily a bad thing, but certainly it's something that's very kind of particular in its function. We don't need it anymore now because we've got other ways of controlling our violence.
Cynthia, I wonder if I could just come to you in a second. The way that the story about Girard's development is often told is that he starts as a literary critic, he starts writing and looking at mimetic desire in, you know, Stendhal and Flaubert and these sorts of people, Dostoevsky, and then he comes to the Gospels, and it seems to be different when he comes to the Gospels. He seems to see something very different in the crucifixion of Christ.
He sees Jesus as the ultimate scapegoat. And it's the revelation that the scapegoat is innocent. And everybody knew as it was happening that it was scapegoating. And so it sort of undermined the whole scapegoat process. And we've been moving in that direction ever since. Unevenly, because, you know, we have all these, you know, places where violence continues to happen. But there is also a growing movement with more and more people wanting peace, wanting reconciliation. The stress on forgiveness, which was very important to René, is a way of controlling the violence.
Alexander, you come from a more secular standpoint. How much importance do you attach to the sort of Christian aspect of Girardian thought?
Well, I think that the Christian aspect is fundamental in the way that Girard tells the story.
Yeah.
Because Girard he has this view of history that history absolutely pivots around the Christian story. But the reason for that is to do with scapegoating. It's not to do with any sort of explicit supernatural interpretation of that, except what's already there in the scapegoating story. So you have these stories throughout many cultural traditions where a figure is kind of cast out, as Girard explains, cast out or killed and somehow comes back, but comes back as a savior, as somehow saving the community. But Girard says that the thing that you don't see in these stories is the savior figure being a victim. Sometimes a savior, you know, is at first a victim and then returns as something like a king or a, you know, vengeful sort of crusading deity. But in Christianity, he thinks for the first time you have scapegoating represented from the point of view of the victim. And Girard thinks that this concern for victims dramatically changes the course of human history. You don't have any concern for victims, he says, in the Roman Empire or in anything pre-Christian, as far as he knows. You know, somebody doesn't say, I'm a victim, therefore I have these rights. But that becomes such a common thing to say after.
The Gospels almost shift, I mean, the way Girard tells the story, they shift history by retelling history from the perspective of the one who is cast out, from the one who is scapegoated, from the one who is the victim.
There's some early intimations of that in the Psalms, where you have those Psalms where the victim says, I am surrounded by my enemies, bad things are about to come down. You have it in the book of Job. He is also a cast out for no apparent reason, rather arbitrarily. So there are intimations of it in the Old Testament, but it, you know, it really comes forward far more explicitly in the New Testament.
And, you know, Girard says also you do, later on he acknowledged that you see this kind of story, the story of Purusha in the Rig Veda as well as in the Hindu tradition. And so, you know, the revelation itself, I think, is not distinctively Christian except by a historical accident for Girard.
Michael, can you just explain to me how this is a salvation story? Who's being saved and how?
Sometimes Girard has been accused of being a Gnostic. In other words, that for him, it's all about knowing what's going on and that the knowledge will somehow save you. Now, whether that's a true description or not, there's certainly the case. Once you know what a situation is, you can do something about it. And as long as we're locked into scapegoating without being aware of what's happening, as long as we're locked into mimetic interactions without being aware of what's happening, then you can't get out of that. So when Jesus cries out on the cross, "Forgive them, Father, they don't know what they're doing," that's a very, very powerful moment, so that people interact violently without really knowing what's going on. And so the Holy Week drama, which is the centre of salvation for the Christian story, the death and the resurrection of Christ, is the moment when we are given a new kind of understanding, what James Allison calls the intelligence of the victim. And so now we know what happens with scapegoating. We recognise it, we call it that. It happens in our classrooms, it happens in my university, it's on our sports pages, it's in our politics.
Yeah.
So we have an understanding of how human beings operate. And once you have that understanding, you have a possibility of transcending that in some way.
You know, Gerard's getting a lot of attention from Peter Thiel and then from J.D. Vance and on the right of American politics. And, you know, these same people, you know, they might talk about, say, refugees or those who are vulnerable in a way that some Girardians might say is a form of scapegoating. Now, I don't want to make this too political, but there seems to be some sort of tension there between what you talk of as the intelligence of the victim and the idea that this is something that's now popular on the American right.
I can say what René Girard himself said about this. "It is difficult for me to say that I'm right or left. When I find myself in a right-wing environment, my reactions are rather left-wing. Naturally, one can accuse me of having fabricated a system that allows me to contradict everyone, which makes me an incorrigible French intellectual."
Alexander.
The irony of this would not have surprised Girard all that much. You know, the fact that on the one hand you have somebody like J.D. Vance expressing admiration for Girard, and on the other hand accusing Haitian immigrants of eating pets, which is precisely the kind of thing that Girard studied in these scapegoating narratives. You know, that the way that archaic communities would scapegoat particular individuals or groups would be to accuse them of these incredibly taboo crimes. But Girard himself was clear that all of the dynamics that lead us towards this scapegoating practice are very much with us. And even when we have the concept, as Michael has said, you know, we now have this concept of scapegoating, which Girard thinks we didn't have before the Christian revelation. But Girard was very clear that we still naturally incline to see the world in the old way, where there really is a single figure who, for some reason, is responsible for all the evils of the world. And if we can just destroy that figure, they'll go away. In fact, you know, Girard was clear that the Christian story itself is often interpreted by Christians in this very old scapegoating way that for some reason that can't fully be understood, the sacrifice of Jesus.
And when Michael talks about the intelligence of the victim, that intelligence is easily lost.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And we haven't fully got it yet, I think Girard would say.
Well,
you know,
it's easily lost, but it's easily distorted as well, because once you realize that there's a kudos from being a victim, you move into the great world of political correctness and wokeness, whatever it is you want to call it, where everybody claims victim status because that's valuable. So this theory can be distorted and twisted around. And I think that's part of what's happening. One of the factors that people are latching onto, what's sometimes known as the kind of apocalyptic thinking in Girard, which came very much to the fore towards the end of his life and his latest writings. And we're talking about, if you like, a theory of turbulence. When you've got the mimetic disturbance, you've got scapegoating, it's making sense of a world where things are not going well. And you turn to apocalyptic language to do that. And that seems to me to be where some of the interest in Girard lies from some of the American thinkers at the moment. They like the fact that he's theorizing about apocalypse, about conflict on a cosmic scale, and they're using that to energize and unite communities, because we all need an enemy, and we're energised by knowing who our enemies are.
Cynthia, does this worry you that his ideas have been taken on by certain right-wing groups?
I think it's a mimetic trend right now. I don't think it's going to last. Mimetic trends usually don't.
Right.
But I think in terms of the apocalyptic stuff, you know, I keep returning to the end of his book, The Scapegoat, and he says the solution is we must forgive one another while there is still time. Soon there will not be time enough. Hmm. He said we have to declare unconditional peace with our neighbors. I don't see that happening.
Not anytime soon. Father Michael, you're a Jesuit. Where does Girard sit in the sort of scale of doctrinal orthodoxy? Is he regarded as sort of like straightforwardly orthodox Catholic, or is there some debate about that?
It depends on the kind of claims that you're making for him. I mean, he always said, I'm not a theologian, but he worked with theologians and certainly worked with Catholic theologians. One of the things that they did was they got him to think differently about sacrifice. You mentioned earlier on that this idea that religion is a bad thing, in particular sacrifice. Sacrifice, he thought, was another name for scapegoating, another name for ritual violence. And he said we shouldn't be using the word as Christians. The notion of sacrifice is very central to Christianity, is very central to Catholic Christianity. So in conversation with Jesuits and others, they gradually talked him round from that. And he said, OK, it's a term that has many meanings and so on. At one point, he said, I'm just an ordinary Catholic. And he regarded himself as mainstream. If you have objections to Girard, it wouldn't be particularly on theological or doctrinal grounds. There might be other things he might have difficulties with.
Alexandra, are we going to be thinking about and talking about Girard in 100 years' time? Is he important?
Yes, absolutely. I think we are. And as Cynthia pointed out, not because of this, you know, latest sort of manifestation of internet memetic culture around the figure of Girard. A lot of that is just meme swapping, you know. I think that we shouldn't over-intellectualize the appeal of that type. Girard was the kind of person who made these very dramatic apocalyptic pronouncements. And there's one line from one of his books where he says, his last book, actually, on Clausewitz, where he says, I believe that history has a meaning and the meaning is terrifying. I think some people on the internet just like to trade, you know, comments
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But, you know, but there's something much deeper, and it's so deep and so fundamental and so simple, and the kind of thought that you can distort and, you know, twist and criticize in all sorts of ways, but because it lies at such a fundamental level, it never really goes away. So for that reason, yeah, I think that we're stuck with this.
Cynthia, why do you think he's important?
He's teaching us a way out of away from violence. His constant emphasis on nonviolence and moving more towards nonviolence, declaring unconditional peace with one's neighbor, how can those things go out of style?
Michael, is that the way you see it?
It is. And I think it's worth picking up something that was said earlier on. Where did he get this stuff from? Where did he get these ideas from? And I think to a certain extent, they got it from within himself because he recognized himself as, under certain situations, a very mimetically driven person. And he was an absolute gentleman and very, very courteous. When he came to London, he said London was a more beautiful city than Paris. You know, you couldn't have been more courteous.
He's right about that. Clearly.
I remember his wife saying, as long as you don't mention the name Jacques Derrida, he's fine. Yes. Well, but Girard became very, very famous in a way that Girard didn't. He'd recognise that as this rivalry within the academy. And he said, this stuff is coming from my own heart. And we speak about a conversion experience in Girard. And I think everybody who gets into Girard has something in their own lives, something in their own background, and said, God, yeah, that was me. Yes, that's how I behaved. And now I'm thinking and working and acting differently. So I think the perennial aspect is on that personal conversion level. You see, this guy's onto something about me.
That's absolutely fascinating. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your wisdom. Girard's always fascinated me, and I found him to be the most interesting and exciting conversation partner. Our guests today were Alexander Douglas, Father Michael Kerwin, and Cynthia Haven. Thank you to all of you. My name's Giles Fraser. This was Beyond Belief.
Beyond Belief was a BBC Audio North production. The producer was Catherine Murray, and the editor was Tim Pemberton. In half an hour, the Sunday programme with William Crawley explores the history of Advent, the Jewish heritage of Sir Tom Stoppard, and asks what a surge in the evangelical population means for Venezuela. But in a moment, On Your Farm visits a ranch in the American Midwest. That's after a look ahead to a new series starting tomorrow morning here on BBC Radio 4.
Britain has a housing crisis.
All the money went on the bond in the first month's rent. I literally had nothing.
Eye-watering costs, escalating homelessness.
Living in our car for a week was petrifying.
And poor housing conditions.
A young boy had lost his life.
In a new series, I'm looking at what went wrong and how to fix it.
It's time to build 1.5 million new homes across the country.
And what else is at stake? Housing Britain, with me, Vicky Spratt, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow morning at 11.
Now, on your farm, Anna Jones is in the United States to meet an American rancher who's won an award for his conservation work.
It's early in the morning and I'm looking across the prairie at an endless sky, shafts of sunlight breaking through a blanket of cloud, just casting the prairie in beautiful golden light. I'm in western South Dakota, a tiny place called Mud Butte, on the Stomprood Angus Ranch. The Stomprood family have been ranching here since 1909, when it was set up as a tiny homestead of 160 acres. Today, it's 6,600 acres, built by three generations of the Stomprood family. And the current custodian is Larry, Larry Stomprood. The only downside is it's swarming with mosquitoes. In the short time I've been recording this introduction, I've had two bites on my hand and one on my face. So I am going to have to go inside to get a first chat with Larry before we head out on the ranch to see his cattle.
Anna, would you like a cup of coffee?
I would love a cup of coffee. Every day on the ranch starts with the same thing.
At least two cups of coffee.
No breakfast?
I'm not a breakfast eater. Two cups of coffee. Until noon.
And then noon, it tools down.
Noon, I need something to eat to fuel up.
I think the first thing I need to see are some cattle. Can we head out onto the ranch to find them?
Sure. It's a ways out there, but we can find a way out there.
Let's brave the mosquitoes and get going, huh?
Yes, yes. Right now we're in one of my summer pastures. We're on our way to check my cattle. There's about 225 in this herd.
I've been to South Dakota a few times. A lot of the time it's sort of brown, but it's incredibly green and lush.
Rain.
You don't normally get much of that though, right?
We have been blessed with a great July.
We're in August now. You can hear the air conditioning going because it is hot out there. I don't know, have you got a temperature gauge? It's 83 degrees Fahrenheit out there at the moment. And it's a little hazy because there are forest fires in Canada and the wind is bringing the smoke right down here in South Dakota, and you can smell it, taste it. Is it common?
No, it's not. This is about as bad as it gets. It's not frequent.
I can see cattle. Here they are.
We're not going to cross here. If you want to go see cattle, we're going to have to walk from here.
Well, I would relish the opportunity for a walk. Let's do it. Is this little, would you call this a creek?
Yes. The primary tree that you see along the creeks here is green ash.
And these, I can't even describe them. They almost look the shape of heather, these plants in the pasture here. What are they?
It's silver sagebrush. There's several species of sagebrush, but silver sage is the dominant species here.
Okay. Let's go. Larry's getting his straw hat on. Larry, it's so fragrant out here. What is that nice smell?
Probably the sage.
Oh, wow. That filled my nostrils when I stepped out the car. what a welcome onto the prairie. That is a beautiful scent. You probably don't even notice it anymore, right?
Oh, I can smell it, but I don't pay much attention to it.
I think when you're in a new environment, these things hit you more.
We'll have to find a place, good place to cross here.
Just walking up and down the creek bed looking for a dry bit.
Here's a place for your little short leg.
Whoop! Yep, there we go. We're across. Hike up the other side. There they are. Is there a bull running with them?
There's 12 bulls.
There's 12 bulls. They don't fight over
there? Oh, yes. they do.
You just let them get on with it.
They sort the pecking order out. We are what they call cow-calf operation. We calve our cows in May and June.
So that means you're not finishing cattle, what we would call finishing or fattening.
No, we generally wean them at about 5 months, and then we'll background them for another 45 to 60 days, and then sell them to a feedlot operation.
So what is background them?
It's just post-weaning. You don't put them on full feed.
Do they go to feedlots in South Dakota or further afield?
In some cases, they'll go to South Dakota, but most of the time, last several years, they've gone to either Nebraska or Iowa.
And how long are they in the feedlot before slaughter?
They generally slaughter them at about 13 to 16 months.
Now, we hear a lot about feedlots in the UK, and it's not always positive. Some people view the feedlot system as a highly intensive system that's feeding high levels of grain. What do you think are the perceptions of American beef across the pond in Europe and in the UK?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions. Rather than abuse our animals, we try and make them just as comfortable as we can, because when they're comfortable, they gain more, they're more profitable for us. So it's to our benefit to take care of them well.
One of the controversial things in Europe is the whole issue around hormone beef. That's something that you had as a system here for a long time and still believe in.
Yes. We can make our cattle more efficient by using hormone implants. The misperception is that we are charging them up with artificial hormones, which is not the case. It's a natural occurring compound or hormone.
But you would give them more than they would naturally have.
We would give them more than they naturally have, but the misconception comes with what the consumer is ingesting. And the amount of additional estrogen is so minuscule.
So if it's so tiny, why do it?
Well, it improves the efficiency of the animal.
How much?
I think as calves, we can see an additional quarter pound of gain per day.
Now that you've turned away from that system, why?
Money. There's a premium for what they call NHTC, or non-hormone beef.
How much more do you get for a non-hormone treated animal compared to a hormone treated?
That varies. The number that's most commonly thrown around is about 30 cents a pound.
So that says to me that this is coming from consumer demand.
I guess you could say that, yes.
I'm fascinated that you have moved away from hormone treatments, because I know this is a system that you have defended passionately, because you're active in the South Dakota Beef Cattlemen's Association, and yet you've decided no, economically we're going to move away from that. Do you think there is a perception that American farmers and ranchers are so wedded ideologically to these systems that it's like, no, you will have our hormone beef whether you like it or not, whereas the reality is, if the consumers are demanding something different, you'll pivot, and you'll change, and you'll give it to them.
I think that's a true statement. We've changed a lot of things over the years as an industry to meet the consumer demand. Let's walk a little closer.
Yeah. They're black Angus cattle, aren't they, Larry?
These are black Angus, yes.
But they weren't always. They've changed color in the history of this ranch. What did they start out as?
My granddad, his first cattle were probably Durham and Shorthorn. And then in the 30s and 40s, he bought Hereford cattle. And that's what I grew up with. And it was primarily a Hereford operation until I retired from the Army and came back in 1995.
You changed everything.
The price differential at that time was about 10 cents a pound, and so since I was getting started out, it was a no-brainer.
Your dad was okay with that?
He was okay with that.
How did you feel saying goodbye to the Herefords?
I still like Herefords, but I could go see him someplace else. That the, you know, money talks.
And how do these guys compare in terms of management and temperament to a Hereford?
I think they're very similar. They're used to people. They get along real good with us. My grandkids can handle them. They've learned how to handle cattle. Sometimes the biggest problem is getting them wound up enough so they'll move for you.
Oh, they can be a little dozy, huh?
Yes.
Look at that mother cow licking her calf.
They think we're going to move them, so they're calling the calves up.
How do you gather?
You know, we used to do most things by horseback. I'm getting old enough now, so I don't get on a horse very often. So we do most of our moving our cattle in, with the four-wheelers, or you might call them quads.
Yep. When were you last on a horse?
I think maybe the last time I was on a horse was during the Buffalo Roundup 2 years ago.
The Buffalo Roundup?
Custer State Park has a herd of American bison. Every year, on the last Friday of September, they have a roundup. It's become quite a tourist attraction.
Oh, I'd love to see that. There would have been a time, hundreds of years ago, when bison were right here.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We've found bison skulls. The grasslands that we have here evolved under the bison. By using the fencing and moving from pasture to pasture, we try to simulate the way that the bison grazed.
Have you ever been stuck out here? Car ever broken down or?
Oh, that happens all the time.
If I got stuck out here, I would be terrified.
This time of the year, we know where we are. Now, on April 5th, 1997, that was a different story.
What happened that day?
I was calving in my calving pasture, which is about a mile from my house. I did a last check on them with the storm coming, and it got so bad while I was out there I couldn't see where I was going and wound up driving into a snowbank, and I was stuck there. And I stayed out there overnight because I didn't dare leave because I'd probably freeze to death. My dad came looking for me in the tractor. I could see his lights about 200 yards away, but I didn't dare leave my vehicle because if I missed him, I wouldn't be able to find my way back.
And then you really would have been in trouble.
Then I would have been in trouble.
When you live somewhere like this, you must have to have the utmost respect for the power of nature.
Can you imagine what those homesteaders were like? Right now, I think we're probably standing on my great uncle's homestead claim on my grandmother's side. We call this dam over here Uncle Delbert's Dam. And my Uncle Mark had a homestead just over that divide there. And my grandmother had her claim straight south of here. The Homestead Act entitled people who wanted to make a claim to 160 acres in most cases of free land if they came, farmed, and stayed for 3 years.
Only 160 acres, but now it's over 6,000 acres. How did that happen?
By necessity. The homesteaders found out early on that 160 acres in this country wouldn't make a living for them. I've read several accounts where the grain that they planted in the spring of 1911 didn't sprout until September. It was that dry. And that ran a lot of them off. Then the Depression came along and the Dirty 30s, that we called them, and that ran a lot more of them off. My grandfather expanded the ranch in 1947 by buying about 4,000 acres.
So how did he get the money to do that? Because he was only a homesteader himself.
He borrowed money. He worked for what is the equivalent of the Farm Service Agency now. He bought cattle for the government in a drought. The government bought cattle and slaughtered them and dumped them in a hole because
so people couldn't afford to feed their cattle.
Exactly. So his Hereford cow herd started that way. When he was out buying cattle for the government, if he saw a nice Hereford herd, he would pay more than what the government was paying, and then he'd take it home for himself.
So there would have been a time, Larry, when there were when there was a community here of homesteaders?
There was somebody on every quarter section, on every 160 acres. They're almost ripe.
What are you eating there?
It's a wild plum that's not quite ripe.
Do you harvest them when they are?
When there's enough of them, we will. They make great jams and jellies.
What's your personal favorite wildlife? What is the species that you love to see on the ranch that gives you joy? Can be a plant or an animal.
I don't know that I have a favorite. You know, I like the pincushion cactus. It's one of my favorites. I like Maximilian sunflower. I like big bluestem grass. Of course, the meadowlark is a favorite, too. We have both the bald eagle and the golden eagle. Probably more golden eagles here than the bald eagle. And during their migration, I've seen as many as 23 along this creek a little further down.
Earlier, you pointed out an antelope. I know that you have coyotes, or coyotes, as we would say out here.
Yes, we have a few. In fact, I saw a couple the other day.
And do they ever give you any trouble with your livestock?
I can't document that we've ever lost a calf to a coyote. But I've suspected it, but never been able to say for certain.
So you live in harmony with your wildlife?
Oh, they probably wouldn't say that.
Why?
I generally, if I get the chance, shoot a coyote.
Why, if it's not harming your livestock?
Well, I guess it's the way I grew up. I have that bias, I guess.
So do you enjoy hunting?
I do.
What is your game here?
Antelope or pronghorn is this is best suited country for pronghorn, but we do have mule deer and white-tailed deer as well. And if you're inclined, our game bird species is the sharp-tailed grouse. But we don't often hunt them, but we probably should this year because we have an abundance of sharp-tails this year. I really enjoy watching the grouse on their mating grounds, or like what's called a lek. The sharp-tail dances with outstretched wings, and they, you know, they beat their little feet on the ground like they're, well, it's hard to describe, but...
Like having a tap dance.
Yes, that's close to it.
What's your whole attitude to environmental management here on the ranch? What's your approach?
I'm not sure quite how I want to answer that. We're given a resource. We manage it the best we can with what knowledge we have. We can't have a cow herd without grass. And the grass suffers if we don't have a cow herd. So from an environmental point of view, we try and take care of the resource, because the resource is what is our bread and butter.
That was such a modest answer to that question, because you could have said, well, Anna, I've just won an award for my conservation practices here on the ranch.
Well, we're pretty proud of that. We're also humbled. It wasn't just me. It was my granddad, and my dad had the land ethic, is how Leopold described it.
This is Aldo Leopold, the writer, author of Sand County Almanac, and a famous ecologist in the States. And you have won the conservation award that he lends his name to. That is a huge accolade.
Well, thank you very much.
There's a marquee on the ranch back home, because you've got quite the public event happening.
There will be. It's in the tent right now.
The tent is the marquee. What is the marquee to you?
Well, a marquee, for us, a marquee is the sign on the front of a theater that tells what movie is playing that day.
See how many things can get lost in translation between British English and American English.
No, I've never heard the word marquee used in that way before.
A big tent.
Big tent.
Big
that
tent.
Would do. Here's what they'll be presenting us.
The 2025 Leopold Conservation Award, Stomprood Angus Ranch.
That's what they call us.
How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm looking forward to the day.
Can't wait to see the ranch full of buzz.
Well, I'm looking forward to the visitors too.
And the buzz of people, not mosquitoes. That'll be nice.
Well, I hope the mosquitoes... We could use a little bit of a breeze to get rid of those mosquitoes. They're kind of hungry.
As you can hear, people are arriving. The ranch is starting to get busy. Cars parking up. People rubbing bug spray into their arms. It's turning into a beautiful day, and I'm happy to say that smoke from the Canadian wildfires is clearing. Can see some blue sky now.
I am Kyra Stomprood. I am Larry Stomprood's granddaughter, so I'm a daughter of Jay and Jen, and I've been on the ranch pretty much my entire life.
And how are you feeling about your grandpa today? I've been spending lots of time talking to him about this award. We've took a tour of the ranch.
I'm very, very proud of him. I know this is something that he's been working towards for a very long time now. So just to be able to see his accomplishments and to see that he's getting recognized for the work he's put in.
I'm Sharon Stomprood Tracy, and I'm Larry's youngest sister. I'm very, very proud of what Larry and the rest of the family has done here. And I think he's well-deserved of this honor, and I'm just so pleased for him.
Does it feel nice to see your parents' home being kept in good faith?
Their heart's desire was for Larry to stay on the ranch and keep the legacy going.
Today, it's no secret, the land ethic is alive and well in landowners across South Dakota. Farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners who are improving soil health, water resources, and wildlife habitat on working land. I would like to invite Larry and his family up.
Very humbled and proud of this award. And from Aldo Leopold, quote, examine each question in terms of what is ethically and aesthetically right, as well as what is economically expedient. I hope I'm doing that.
On Your Farm was presented and produced by Anna Jones. It was a BBC Audio Bristol production. Time for the weather forecast now. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thank you, Richard. Well, it's really quite unsettled for the next few days. It's going to be wet and windy at times, and certainly there's some heavy rain around for many of us today. Just curiously mild too for December, temperatures well above the seasonal average. So for today then, low pressure very much in charge, band of rain pushing northwards and eastwards. There's quite a contrast in temperatures this morning. So 13 or 14 degrees Celsius across parts of the Isles of Scilly, actually. So very mild here towards the southwest, but there has been a touch of frost across northeastern parts of Scotland, so much cooler here. Now, for Wales, southern England and Northern Ireland this morning, it's cloudy. It's really quite mild. There's some hill and some coastal fog around, outbreaks of rain gradually creeping further northwards and eastwards. It's already with us in the far southwest, of course, across parts of South Wales as well. But for Scotland, Northern England and East Anglia, it's a cooler start to the morning. There are some brighter spells around as well, but it will be clouding over later. And eventually we are going to be seeing that rain as well. So the rain band pulls northeastwards. It will reach eastern England, central Scotland through the early to mid-afternoon. And some of the rain is likely to be heavy, mostly for northwestern England, Northern Ireland and North Wales as well. So some heavy downpours here, but the rain will spread everywhere. For the far southwest of England and for Wales, the rain should clear later on through the afternoon. There'll be some brighter spells. And actually for Northern Ireland, for Northern Scotland and for the Northern Isles, it should stay dry for most of the daylight hours. There will be some early brightness and then it will gradually cloud over. The winds are coming in from the southeast, but then they'll turn southwesterly. Near gale force, actually, for the south coast and the Channel Islands. So very windy here and windy later for Irish sea coasts as well. But the air is very mild. Scotland, 7 to 10 degrees Celsius, 9 to 12 for Northern Ireland and 12 to 15 degrees Celsius for England and Wales. A quieter day tomorrow.
Later this morning, Hugh Dennis reports on some of the lives changed since last year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal.
For many people, experiencing homelessness or living in temporary accommodation, a secure and stable home may be all they're wishing for.
The situation I was in, I didn't have any money at all.
Going from B&B one night to the next night, not knowing where he was going to be.
But your donations to last year's Radio 4 Christmas Appeal made a difference.
It's a happy time. Get to all see all the family it is.
The Radio 4 Christmas Appeal, making a difference. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this morning at 9:45.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 7th of December. Good morning. This is Tina Ritchie. Ministers say they'll offer guaranteed construction and hospitality work to curb youth unemployment. More than 20 people, including tourists, have died in a nightclub fire in the Indian state of Goa. The US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth has described American airstrikes on alleged drug smugglers as righteous. Thousands of guaranteed jobs in sectors such as construction and hospitality are to be offered to young people on benefits as part of an £800 million government package to tackle rising youth unemployment. The measure will also offer training and job interviews to try to shift claimants into work. Those who fail to engage with the scheme could see benefit payments cut. Our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
There are almost a million young people in the UK who are not in education, employment or training, and the number is rising. This funding, the government says, will mean 350,000 on universal credit will get training and exposure to work in construction, hospitality and health and social care to break down barriers to employment. Others will get intensive support to help them find jobs and, starting in the spring, 55,000 government-backed guaranteed jobs will start to be made available. The Work and Pension Secretary Pat McFadden described it as an attempt to create real pathways into good jobs. But the government says those who don't engage with the support without good reason could face unspecified sanctions to their benefits. The Conservatives said tax rises implemented by the Chancellor were driving up youth unemployment. And the government was taking with one hand to give back with the other.
Police in India say at least 25 people have been killed in a fire at a nightclub in Goa. It's thought a gas cylinder exploded in the club's kitchen. Davina Gupta reports from Delhi.
The blaze tore through the beachfront nightclub in North Goa at midnight local time, catching people off guard. Eyewitnesses described scenes of chaos as firefighters fought to contain the flames, which rescue teams say they were largely limited to the kitchen and the ground floor. Most of the victims are believed to be club employees. The fire is now under control and authorities are still identifying the bodies. The state's chief minister visited the site earlier and has launched a formal inquiry into how the fire started. North Goa is one of the region's busiest tourist destinations at this time of year, known for its nightlife and beach clubs.
West Midlands Police says one of its senior officers never intended to imply that members of the Jewish community supported the banning of fans from the Israeli club Maccabi Tel Aviv from a match against Aston Villa. The decision not to allow Israeli supporters to attend the Europa League game last month sparked a political row. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
Senior police officers from the West Midlands faced questioning from the Cross-Party Home Affairs Committee last Monday about their role in the controversial decision to ban away supporters on safety grounds. Ultimately, Maccabi Tel Aviv didn't take up its ticket allocation. The Assistant Chief Constable, Mike O'Hara, said there were a range of faiths, backgrounds and ethnicities that were very concerned about the fixture. When he was asked by the chair of the committee, Karen Bradley, if that included Jewish people, he said yes, and that this had been documented in a community impact assessment. But the force has now said that in answering these questions, it was never the intention to imply that there were members of the local Jewish community who backed the fans' exclusion. The Sunday Times has reported that Mr O'Hara has now written to representatives of the community in Birmingham to apologise.
The US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth has described American attacks on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Pacific and the Caribbean as righteous, and he likened drug smugglers to terrorists. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent Sean Dilley.
It was a speech aimed at a military audience, but clearly intended to be heard around the world. Pete Hegseth said that, like Ronald Reagan, President Trump believed in deploying service personnel as a last resort, but he said the Department of War would wield its sword as President Trump directs. Pointing to US strikes on alleged drugs boats, he said the days in which, in his words, narco-terrorists operated freely in our hemisphere were over. He went on to liken the organizations to Al-Qaeda. His message to anyone who he said was working for a designated terrorist organization and wanted to bring drugs to the US was, "We will find you and we will sink you." It was an uncompromising message, as criticism over the US's action in the Caribbean Sea among allies and opponents has intensified.
Voting is taking place in elections in Hong Kong, where there's anger about a fire in a block of flats 11 days ago which killed 159 people. Candidates are strictly vetted. Turnout figures are likely to come under scrutiny, with many regarding the poll as a test of confidence in the pro-Beijing authorities. Russia has carried out missile and drone attacks overnight, targeting infrastructure in central Ukraine. The mayor of Kremenchuk said power and water supplies had been disrupted. Key European powers will underline their support for Kyiv tomorrow, when the Prime Minister hosts the leaders of Ukraine, France and Germany at Downing Street. Here's our World News correspondent, Joe Inwood.
This meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, British and French-led supporters of Ukraine, is designed to reiterate the fact that Kyiv still has friends, even as relations with Washington have grown more distant. But Europe has been increasingly sidelined by the US-led efforts to find a negotiated settlement to a conflict that has, so far, proved intractable. That process has been continuing in Miami in recent days, with high-level US and Ukrainian delegations holding rounds of meetings to try to refine a plan that was previously discussed with Moscow. President Zelensky said a phone call with Donald Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff and the US leader's son-in-law Jared Kushner was very constructive. What is not yet clear is whether there has been genuine progress or if Mr. Zelensky is simply trying to remain positive for fear of angering the US president.
Cricket, England have taken a slender lead on the fourth day of the Brisbane Test as they battle to avoid going 2-0 down in the Ashes. Having resumed on 134 for 6, the England captain Ben Stokes, together with Will Jacks, have taken the visitors to 109 in their second innings, putting them ahead by 32 runs. The Formula One title will be decided this afternoon by a dramatic three-way contest in the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. Britain's Lando Norris leads the standings by 12 points, but he's being chased by his McLaren teammate Oscar Piastri and four-time world champion Max Verstappen. Joe Curry reports.
It's being billed as the most exciting Formula One title race in years, the final move of a chess game that's lasted 24 races. But who will win? Britain's Lando Norris starts in second on the grid, but he knows that if he crosses the finish line in the top three, he'll claim his first ever world title. But hot on his heels will be his McLaren teammate, the Australian Oscar Piastri, and Red Bull's Max Verstappen from the Netherlands, the reigning champion. At one point during the season, the Dutchman was more than 100 points off the pace, but mistakes by McLaren have put him back in contention. He starts on pole today, eyeing a fifth consecutive championship. Lewis Hamilton, meanwhile, will begin the race in 16th place and is in danger of finishing his first season with Ferrari without a single podium place.
And now for a look at the Sunday papers. An accusation by senior barristers that the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has misrepresented figures about the collapse of rape cases is the lead in the Sunday Times. It's claimed he did this in order to push through the abolition of some jury trials in England and Wales. The paper reports that the Justice Secretary suggested 60% of victims are pulling out of cases because of delays in the court system. But the paper quotes two barristers who say the true statistics show the vast majority of reported rape claims are abandoned before a charge is even brought. The Ministry of Justice said the lawyer's comments were completely misleading. A full-page photo of Sir Keir Starmer is on the front page of The Observer. In an interview, the Prime Minister insists he will fight on in the role and predicts that the former Labour Deputy Leader Angela Rayner will return to the Cabinet. Sir Keir claims that both her and the Chancellor Rachel Reeves have suffered from misogyny at Westminster. The Express leads with claims that dozens of foreign nationals who are deemed a threat to national security face constant monitoring because human rights laws prevent them from being deported. The paper says there are fresh calls for the UK to overhaul these laws and leave the European Convention on Human Rights. The Border Security and Asylum Minister, Alex Norris, tells The Express that new laws to rapidly deport terrorists are coming. The Duchess of Sussex father, Thomas Markle, has told The Mail on Sunday that he still hasn't heard from his daughter as he recovers in hospital. The paper explains that his left leg has been amputated below the knee. Mr. Markle says that he wants to see Meghan one last time before he dies. And that concludes our look at the papers.
And that was Gina Ritchie. This is Radio 4. His nostalgic vision of a child's Christmas in Wales is a favourite at this time of year, and the inspiration of the work of Dylan Thomas features in Sunday Worship from Swansea in an hour's time. Now, though, it's Sunday with William Crawley.
Thanks very much. Good morning. The Christian filmmaker who claims he was banned from a National Trust site because of his faith goes head-to-head with the Trust Director on today's programme. Is this a case of anti-Christian bias, a culture war skirmish, or a misunderstanding that's been blown out of proportion? We'll also tell the story of how the playwright Sir Tom Stoppard discovered he was Jewish and how he explored that revelation in his work.
It took quite a long time for him to integrate that particular perspective, that element of his life, into both his private life and, of course, his creative life.
And you may already be a week into your Advent calendar, but have you any idea why you have one?
The lights, the music, the markets, the friendships, the family, the trying to find the most unusual gifts.
As always, your emails to sunday@bbc.co.uk. As US warships gather in the Caribbean and the prospect of a military strike on Venezuela increases, the country is grappling with a religious shift that is reshaping its politics. Once overwhelmingly Catholic, Venezuela has seen its evangelical population surge from just 4% in the 1970s to nearly 30% today. A change unfolding as President Maduro faces international rejection of his 2024 election victory and mounting pressure from Donald Trump's White House. Earlier, I spoke to Dr. Fernando Mora, an academic and former pastor in Venezuela who has spent years studying the rise of evangelicalism in his country. And I began by asking him how people there are coping as they watch reports of a potential military clash with the United States.
For the most part, people is very quiet, not talking too much about it, and trying to prepare for Christmas time is very important in Venezuela. But if you scratch them a little bit, you will see that there is some anxiety present in everybody.
And then since September, we've seen more than 80 people killed in 21 military strikes on boats in the South Caribbean. How is that being seen? How is that being processed by people?
Well, from the majority of the people here, they feel that this is something that should be done differently by taking the drug traffickers to court, not using the force as it's been done. But we are not sure how many of these are really Venezuelans that have been struck by the bombs. Venezuelans are more worried about the first strike, which was actually Venezuelan boat with 11 people, that, and it's the one that's being talked about currently.
Can I ask about where religion fits into that mix and give us a sense of how religion breaks down in the country of Venezuela?
Venezuelans are by far Christian, so it's going to be around 90-95% population that are Christians. And there are also a few other groups that are, you know, visible in the country, but they are not, their numbers are not that big. So that's how I would say the distribution is at this point. Mostly majority Catholic, and then a growing population of evangelicals, Protestants. But I have to say that of these protesters, about 80 to 85% are Pentecostals, okay?
And President Maduro has developed a really quite intimate relationship over the past while with evangelicals as a growing population within the country. How do you explain that connection?
Yeah, that goes back to Hugo Chavez's government. He was backed by a large group of evangelicals when he went into campaign in 1998. But Maduro, in this, let's say, 5 years, I would say, has been more intentional in reaching out to evangelicals. So that's the reason why you see this closeness at this point, I would say.
Why do so many evangelicals in Venezuela support President Maduro?
Venezuelan evangelicals were kind of a despised population in the country. So because the Catholics were very hegemonic in terms of religion, they didn't allow evangelicals to operate freely years back. Being recognized as a population is something that is important. So I think that in the first place, there is the recognition aspect. So if you recognize them, that's one good reason to get support. And I think that was Chavez's strategy. But the second aspect is has to do with a different trend in evangelicalism globally, which has to do with the new trends in theology and understanding of the church. So trying to get to power is important as well. So I think that's the second reason why this group probably are getting closer to the government. They see they can influence with Christianity this particular situation.
So you've got evangelicals who have felt marginalized historically in Venezuela, who now feel that they're brought more into the center and given cultural recognition. And at the same time, they also want to have more political power themselves in order to advance their own Christian evangelical views into government policy. And on the other side, you've got a president who needs their support electorally and is offering them financial support in return. And both sides are benefiting from that connection, that relationship.
That's correct.
Do you think that those evangelicals in that story you've just told us, do you think they believe that President Maduro is spiritually honest with them, or is he using them? Is he exploiting them for his own political purposes?
No, I think they probably feel that he's growing as a Christian.
He tells a conversion story, doesn't he?
Yeah, but we, as evangelicals, we know that you don't become a Christian one night to the next. So it takes a process. So I think they believe in the process. They say that he will change, and he's learning and studying the Bible and probably growing.
Which is, interestingly, another connection with evangelicals in the United States who say exactly the same thing about Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, that's how these converge in this theology that I'm going to. So it's there is one trend that is called the New Apostolic Reformation, and a particular teaching that is called the Seven Mountains Mandate, which the church has to take control or power of seven specific areas of society, like government, education, arts and entertainment, and different other ones. So if you can reach to these different spheres of power, that's a good thing, because you can then influence from the top down with Christianity culture.
That is fascinating. So those who have bought into this new apostolic reformation teaching, they believe that President Maduro can be the vehicle for the transformation of their country, Venezuela, into something theologically that looks more like what they would like to see.
Yeah, that's how I interpret that.
Dr. Fernando Moro there from Caracas. Some of you early risers may have heard our sister programme, Bells on Sunday, at 5:43 this morning. Well, on this very day, 45 years ago, Bells on Sunday was first broadcast on Radio 4. So we asked the poet, broadcaster and former bell ringer, Ian McMillan, to celebrate that sublime interplay of clapper and metal.
The tower captain is holding the rope in his hands, and the Sally's stripes are like a barber's pole. There's a sense of anticipation in the air. Not just anticipation, campanological anticipation. Iron mouths are about to speak. The tower captain looks around the ringing chamber like a minor royal inspecting a guard of honour. "Look to," the captain says. "Treble's going, she's gone." And the eight bells of All Saints ring out across the valley, and the teenaged me, ringing bell number 4, is in heaven. Not just heaven, campanological heaven. We're doing call changes today for morning prayer. Last Thursday, we were practicing tittums, the wonderfully named pattern of eight bells that sounds, to the untrained ear, like titum, titum. For many years, I had the joy of being a bell ringer for Sunday services, for weddings, for which you get a small fee, for funerals, when the bells rang half-muffled with a deep mourning sound, and on practice nights, which were always Thursdays. Of course, Being a bell ringer is not like being a piccolo player. The piccolo player can rehearse in a small room and then perform on a huge stage. But the bell ringer practices and performs in the same arena. And mistakes as well as triumphs can be heard for miles around. Like life, really. For me, as a poet, one of the main joys of bell ringing is the language. I've mentioned some of the shining jewels already. The leader is a tower captain. The room where the bell ringers stand is a ringing chamber. And the stripy bit on the rope is the sally. The smallest bell is the treble, and the largest one is the tenor. Call changes are when the tower captain calls out which bells should ring when. And tittums, glorious tittums, that aforementioned method for ringing eight bells, which goes 1, 5, 2, 6, 3, 7, 4, 8, from tenor to treble. And campanology, of course, a word that only people who never ring bells call bell ringing, except ironically, like I did earlier, and bells are always female. In the pub, after practice night, we'd have endless debates about whether ringing was a science or an art, a skill or a craft, and we could never quite decide. That is, until one Thursday night in 1974, when I lost concentration for a moment, my rope wrapped around my body, and as the bell swung, I was taken swiftly into the air like a trampolinist and flung around the ringing chamber, catching glimpses of my fellow ringers and the room in a way that I'd never seen them before. And as I bounced above their heads, I realised that bell ringing was a way of seeing the world differently, as a place of almost mathematical order that could at any moment be disrupted, and that stood me in good philosophical stead ever since. Look too, Ian's going, he's gone. Yeah, that sounds like tittums too.
Wasn't that fabulous? The poet Ian McMillan recalling his former days as a bell ringer. So much has already been written about the playwright Sir Tom Stoppard since his death at the age of 88 was announced last weekend. He is celebrated for a body of work that combines incisive wit, emotional depth, empathy and generosity, and for the technical brilliance with which he built imaginative worlds on stage. His final play, Leopoldstadt, follows a fictional Jewish family in Vienna through the upheavals of the 20th century, and it resonates closely with his own story. Tom Stoppard only discovered his Jewish heritage at the age of 55, learning at the same time that all four of his grandparents and much of his wider family were murdered in Nazi concentration camps. He reflected on that revelation on Radio 4's Front Row.
So how Jewish were we? My mother having stalled on this, I finally asked the question of a cousin in the very early 90s, and she said, "What do you mean, how Jewish are you? You're Jewish." And she drew a family tree for me. There were one or two things in the play, like the drawing of a family tree. She explained everything. And so I very rapidly discovered that, my mother had had sisters who died. All four grandparents had died.
To understand how the discovery of his Jewish identity played out in the life and work of Tom Stoppard, we turn to one of his biographers, Ira Nadel, author of Double Act, The Life of Tom Stoppard.
His mother did not want the boys, Tom and his brother Peter, to face any threats, to face any dangers once they had moved to England in 1946. And then she told some people much later, before she died in 1996, that their life really began in 1946, when they arrived in England. You might say she covered up the story, but on the other hand, she would have argued and did argue at the very end of her life that she protected her two boys by not identifying their Jewishness.
What, if any, influence did that have on him beyond the age of 55, as he saw himself in the world, as he continued to write?
It took quite a long time for him to integrate that particular perspective, that element of his life, into both his private life and, of course, his creative life. There was a celebration of the traditional Jewish holidays, Hanukkah, Passover, that sort of thing, with his second wife, Dr. Miriam Stoppard. It was more an identity that was hidden rather than an identity that was lived. And it's not until the 90s, again, with the inklings and then the discovery of the authenticity of his Jewish past, specifically of the mother, because in the Jewish tradition, it's the mother that determines, if you will, that kind of identity. I think it took him quite a bit of time to integrate that Jewishness.
So you're not suggesting that, for example, he would attend synagogue or engage in the rituals or practices of Judaism? It was an identity that he had to come to terms with, in a sense.
Yes, it was an identity and not a practice.
Right.
Even with the last major play, Leopoldstadt, which is produced in 2020, it was, I think, very difficult for him. And yet the play is the working out of all of these, if you will, lines of force that are finally coming together within his psyche, within his, of course, identity. And this play is really quite remarkable, and not for its production and not for the scale of the play, but with very simple things, because the play begins at Christmas and the play ends with the Passover Seder. And that journey really, I think, explains a great deal of what happens to Tom Stoppard, or happened to Tom Stoppard.
Ara, what was he like as a person?
I did spend quite a bit of time with him. He was generous. He was very thoughtful. He loved to quip. And he was concerned about you, asking me, did I contact so-and-so? Did I get enough information? He would never directly tell me, but he would give me hints. He wanted to be sure I got the story right. And that was very characteristic of Tom Stoppard, because he did so much research, as I'm sure you're aware, for all of his plays, whether they involved physics, mathematics, history. Now, he wouldn't call me on the phone to tell me, you know, did I remember that was a Tuesday in 1968 or something? But he would say to me, go to the archives of the National Theater and look at the production notes of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And they were marvelous.
Ira Nadell. O Come Emmanuel, that can almost be the soundtrack of Advent, the annual countdown to Christmas, and you may be literally counting down with the help of one of the seemingly endless varieties of Advent calendars now on the market. Rosa Forrest and Liz Robinson from Yorkshire have been speaking to Katie Booth about what they would like to see in their ideal Advent calendar.
I think I'd like to see a well-being advent calendar, things to do for yourself, to help yourself, self-care, but also things to help and support others and show kindness.
What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear the word advent?
Oh, well, much to my friend Rosa's horror, it's chocolate. It's an advent calendar that just marks down the countdown.
And if you could design an advent calendar, there's lots of different types these days, what would you like?
Very bad for me, but probably gin behind every window.
They actually do
gin calendars, haven't
they? And what's your favourite thing about this time of year?
The lights, the music, the markets, the friendships, the family, the trying to find the most unusual gifts. For me, personally, it's about the recognition I could help somebody else. I try to do that from beginning of December onwards, really.
Advent calendars are just one of the many traditions that have emerged and evolved, actually, over many centuries in connection with this annual liturgical journey. Think of the coloured candles, the Advent wreaths, the Advent carols themselves, and more besides. How did all of that come about? Let's take you on an historical tour of Advent. Our guide is Dr. Colin Donnelly, Associate Professor in Reformation and Early Modern Christianities at Oxford. Colin, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, William. Lovely to be with you.
When and where does this begin, Advent?
Well, you can't have Advent until you have Christmas first. But actually, in the very early centuries of the church, Christmas is not really a big deal. Easter is the main focus in the early church. It's really only until the 4th century that Christmas is kind of established as a major feast. And even then, you don't really get that clear sense of Advent. The liturgical calendar is still beginning. So the earliest that you can kind of trace something that's like Advent is in the 5th century in Gaul, in what's now France. They begin to celebrate something called St. Martin's Lent, beginning on the 11th of November, 1111, the Feast of St. Martin, a great saint who famously cut his cloak in half to give to a poor beggar. So there's a sense then that in this period leading up to Christmas, starting with this kind of penitential holiday, you're having a kind of winter Lent. So it's not like Advent calendars. It's not, you know, there's no gin behind the doors or any, certainly not chocolate, anything like that. It's penitential. You're getting ready for the coming of Christ, not only in Bethlehem, but also at the end of time. So you have to sort of be starting to get ready for that.
So we move historically from that fasting, that penitential approach to, yes, and those rituals, to some of the celebratory aspects today of candles, wreaths, and the like. When did that come about?
Well, candles and wreaths don't come about till way later. What really begins to emerge is in the following centuries, as the liturgical calendar develops, you start to get the sense that there are a fixed number of Sundays where you're having special liturgies prior to the lead up to Christmas. So by the 7th century in Rome, you get a sense that there's maybe 5 Sundays where you have special services leading up to Christmas. In other cities, they're doing other things, 6 in Toledo, 6 in Milan, that kind of thing. So really by the High Middle Ages, you're getting something much more like the modern Advent. In the 13th century, Gaudete Sunday, which is next Sunday coming up, it's a great command, rejoice, right? Not just be joyful, but command, rejoice Sunday. That comes about in the 13th century. So by the High Middle Ages, you have not quite Advent calendars and things like that yet, but something much closer to our modern sense of Advent as a kind of set of 4 weeks leading up to Christmas, where you have all of these special celebrations, and it's moving into a little bit more of a rejoicing feeling, although there's still that penitential aspect as well.
We better drag you into your academic specialism, the Reformation period, Germany, Martin Luther. What happened in that period?
Well, the Reformation is fascinating when it comes to Advent, because you might think that this would be, you know, a difficult moment for Advent. Remember, the logic of the Reformation is they want to get rid of all of these medieval Catholic traditions that they see as superstitious. They're not in the Bible. They want to get back to a sort of purely biblical religion. But Protestants kind of split on this. Luther loves Advent, actually, and Luther loves all of those kinds of aspects of it. Famously, he translates and adapts Ambrose of Milan's hymn, Savior of the Nations Come, and this is kind of now in Germany the classic Advent carol, a bit like O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, or something like that here. So this celebration actually sort of strengthens and takes on something of a more joyful kind of expectation-laden sense in Lutheran Germany in the Northeast. But also, the other big branch of Protestantism, of course, as you'll know very well, William, is Reformed Protestantism. And they tend to have a slightly stricter approach. So they get rid of the liturgical calendar, that series of readings of which Advent is the beginning. Many of them keep Advent as a series, as a sort of season of penitential preaching. But it's let's say, de-emphasized, because there isn't the same stress on the liturgical calendar that you get in other forms of Christianity.
I've only got 20 seconds left, Colin, but is this a uniquely Western tradition, Advent, or is it more global in terms of Christianity?
Well, Eastern Christianity does also have a season of preparation for Christmas, but it retains much more of that fasting penitential quality than the more celebratory, excited expectation, joyful expectation, as Vatican II calls it, that we have now in the West.
Colin, brilliant. Thank you very much, Dr. Colin Donnelly from Oxford. It's 27 minutes to 8, still to come. We speak to a leading Islamic scholar from Nigeria who thinks talking, rather than military action, could end the violence in his country.
There are people fighting, saying they have grievances and they are trying to survive. So I think instead of continued bloodshed, we can sit down.
Did the National Trust refuse permission for filming at one of its sites because the documentary being made was of a religious nature? The independent filmmaker Christian Holden sought permission to use St. Cuthbert's Cave in Northumberland for a film about the saint. The reply he received from the National Trust mentioned concerns about its religious affiliation. That single phrase has sparked coverage in Christian and national media, and some have already tried to frame that as part of a wider culture war. The National Trust, for its part, says there is more to this story. Let's see if we can get to the bottom of this, shall we, as we bring together for the first time the filmmaker Christian Holden and Andy Beer, Director of Strategy and Places at the National Trust. Good morning to both of you. Glad to have you with us. Christian, take us back to what happened when you applied for permission to film at this site.
Of course, this was back in June of this year, and as customarily I would do apply for permission at any private sites, at privately owned land or properties. The response I had, the initial response, was that it is our policy not to host any filming of a religious nature. And we had some conversation back and forth with that person at the National Trust. Eventually, I had this final response that they will not be able to host the filming because of its religious affiliation, and that this is mandated at the highest level of the National Trust.
So that was the phrase that you got. That was the phrase that was used in the email, mandated at the highest level of the National Trust. Let me come to Andy on that. Do you have a policy that we should know about, Andy?
Oh, good morning. No, we don't. No, we don't have a policy of that nature. What's happened here is that we've made a bit of a mistake.
Say more. How did that happen?
Well, I think you've got to understand the context of teamwork. And we have thousands of requests every year for filming. And actually, although it might sound easy to accommodate, our places are often managed by others, very often farm tenants, and we've got and they're very often very sensitive. So in order to undertake filming, we need to consult all sorts of statutory agencies and so on, and think about the protection of the site. So we usually say no to filming, and we do it by exception where it meets our charitable purpose. So in this instance, the team member concerned has clearly quoted a policy which doesn't exist in saying no, and got into a debate by email, which is normally ill-advised in my experience. So when I became aware of this a few weeks ago, I dropped a note to Mr. Holden to ask if we could speak and seek to resolve the matter.
Christian, do you accept that this was a cock-up rather than a conspiracy?
If it was only one member of staff, then I would say, okay, fair enough, we could look at that. But when it's a second, more senior member of staff comes in and backs up the same policy, and in fact, both are fairly, from my reading, fairly senior members of staff. One is a filming and locations executive. The other is senior filming and locations manager. You know, these are not sort of work experience employees. They're fairly experienced staff members. So it is troubling that we've got this response consistently with the more senior manager coming back to me and again reaffirming we do not accept filming of a religious nature, when in fact we can demonstrate that that's untrue.
Andy, this does sound very strange that you have significant managers telling Christian that there is a policy that excludes his film.
Well, we've got a very small film and locations team of about three or four people who deal with all sorts of requests we get every year. Mm-hmm. So Christian was in conversation with those. And normally, actually, they work really effectively to facilitate filming or to be courteous when we're unable to accommodate it. I work with 50,000 staff and volunteers, and every now and again somebody doesn't get it quite right or gets frustrated and does something wrong. And obviously I want to be supportive to them, but I've had follow-on conversations with both members of staff involved and made really clear that there are lots of reasons why we might not want to undertake filming. They're practical or operational related to the conservation of sites, but they're not related to any other factors.
Christian, I understand this is not the first time you've had difficulties getting permission from the National Trust.
Well, I had dealings in 2015 when I approached to film at a site at St. John, Jerusalem, Sutton at Hone, which is down in Kent. And again, that was following an email there. The initial response I had was that we don't allow religious filming, religious or political filming. And I followed on with a telephone call and eventually was able to obtain permission to film there. So it's strange that over this course of time, and in fact, the person I dealt with then back in 2015 was the senior manager now that I that had the final response from. So it is a bit troubling that we've got this consistent response, this reticence to permit religious filming, when, of course, so much of our heritage sites and so much of so many of the sites that the National Trust is has management and oversight of have a Christian heritage, have a Christian history, not least at St. Cuthbert's Cave.
And I know that some people, Andy, have wondered if what this story tells us is that there is a nervousness about Christianity or religion in the National Trust or indeed some other national bodies, and that has played out in kind of culture war language. Can you address that criticism for us?
Yeah, I mean, that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, first of all, obviously, I'd like to apologise to Mr. Holden for the upset we've caused him, and I'll make a commitment here that I can ensure that an issue like this won't happen again, and I've been speaking to the team concerned. In terms of our approach to Christianity, you have to remember that National Trust was, you know, we were one of our three founders was a vicar. Our places have got, many of them have got churches in the grounds, and I'd really invite everybody to go and visit a National Trust place this Christmas and just see how we're celebrating the season. I know this evening we've got a sold-out carol concert at Fountains Abbey, we've got garlands at Cateel in Cornwall, and our houses look absolutely amazing dressed for Christmas. And we will have all sorts of traditional activities at this time of year. And we stand as a place that brings people together.
You've impressively turned that apology into an ad for the National Trust. I'll just put that finally to Christian. Do you accept that apology?
Well, it's certainly reassuring to hear that about the for any Christians visiting the National Trust sites, that there is this focus on recognising the Christian heritage and history and valuing that in our nation. So, yes.
Thank you both very much, Christian Holden and Andy Beer. As the city of Glasgow celebrates its 850th anniversary this year, an ancient holy well, hidden for centuries in the crypt of Glasgow Cathedral, has been dramatically brought back to life. The well has now been transformed into the Wellspring, a striking mosaic of glass and light created by the artist Joanna Kessel. The installation evokes the legend of St. Mungo, also known as St. Kentigern, the city's patron saint. Paul English went along to find out more.
Down in the green meadow, all under a tree.
Joanna, how are you doing?
Yeah, doing well. Thanks Please. Very much for coming.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Can't wait to see it.
Well, let's go this way. We're going through the
back. Hi, I'm Joanna Kessel. I'm the artist who's working with Approxima Arts on this amazing Glasgow Wellspring project. We've lined the well with 24-carat gold-leaf glass mosaic. There's 950 plates. It's looking stunning. The install's going on at the moment, and it's the first opportunity today that we've had to see it in place.
How does it feel?
Overwhelming, actually. Really wonderful, quite magical. We've all got a huge sense of uplift, both by getting to this stage, but also what it looks like. It's really powerful.
Tell me how this came to be, Joanna, that you are here in Glasgow Cathedral installing a well that tells a really significant part of this city's story.
Basically, I met Angus Farker, who's the creative director of Approxima, and he'd heard about my mosaic work, came to the studio, and the next day I was over in Glasgow, so visited. Angus was talking about potential projects using mosaic in the lower church, and he turned to me and said, if you could do anything, what would you do? And I knew instantly, having looked at Byzantine glass mosaic in basilicas and the work of the Venetian architect Carlo Scarpa, I said to Angus, Oh, I'd line the well with gold leaf mosaic. I could just imagine the illumination and the luminescence that would come out of this well shaft, which is in a dark corner. I'm hoping with the mosaic that there's some sense of taking people from this internal dark space to nature, to the natural environment where the well would have been originally, and a sense of the sky, light coming down through the leaves being cast on a water surface. And then as humans, as we shift from foot to foot, you start to see below the water, looking down into the earth, so that this well shaft will really transport people in a magical way.
How does it feel as an artist, Joanna, to have a place now in this medieval building? You're part of it now. You're part of its future story.
Do you know, I haven't thought about that before. Thanks. Thanks for asking me that. Just amazing. Very rare does an artist get asked, what would you do if you could do anything? And to be able to then pursue that. So it's not been compromised, the original thought. It's a bit of a gift to the people of Glasgow and to the people who come and take the time to peer over and down into the well. I'm hoping people feel a real sense of awe and wonder. Yeah, a real privilege.
You bathe in my water, so cool on your skin. And you built a new home by the wellspring.
I'm Angus Farker, Creative Director of Approxima Arts. About 2 years ago, I found out that there was this forgotten well that was actually built into the buttresses. So we're looking at a 775-year-old well that used to provide lustral water for a great Cistercian cathedral, so for mass and for exorcism. And it was part of an amazing ritual centre that we stood in with these amazing medieval vaulted arches that surround us. And here, back in that period, a shrine was built to St. Kentigern, who was the founding saint of Glasgow, who had a little cell and used to baptise people in a river called the Mullandina Burn that sits below us. So he had a shrine built to him in that church, and hundreds of thousands of people came over the centuries, right the way up to the Reformation. The well was prescribed. Protestant faith did not do wells, and so people were banned, they weren't allowed to go to them, and it really fell out of use. And even now in the 21st century, when I first came here to see it, there was no signage, it was dark, and yet hundreds of people had thrown coins down it over the last 75 years. So we knew that it was still being used. People were still making quiet blessings here. And I thought, wouldn't it be incredible to bring this back into popular consciousness again? This is our chance to really recognize that this tiny conduit down into the earth, where natural water still pours in from the heavy rains in Glasgow, you have the point where this actual city started.
You're staging a concert to effectively shine a light on the well.
We thought it'd be really lovely to dedicate it, and the cathedral has this remarkable nave which has been used as a public space for centuries, and we're working with Corinne Polwart, very well known Scottish artist, musician, has written the most beautiful song just called The Wellspring, which tells the story particularly from Kentigern's mother's perspective, Saint Thenu, or Enoch, who is kind of, as often with women, a bit written out of history. So it tells her story and dedicates the well to her as well. By wellspring we mean it's a place where you can have good thoughts and good feelings. Just care for yourself, care for the people around you, and wish for a better world.
And carry the song of the wellspring.
The singer Corinne Polwart there, ending that report from Paul English at the opening of the Wellspring in Glasgow Cathedral. More than 7,000 Christians have been killed in Nigeria this year alone, a staggering figure that has provoked claims of genocide. But there's another side to the story. Muslims have also been killed and kidnapped in large numbers, a fact sometimes lost in Western media reports. The criminal gangs behind the surge in abductions have targeted both Christians and Muslims. While some churches have been destroyed, yes, so too have mosques. So how should we understand the character of the violence across Nigeria? One of Nigeria's most controversial Muslim clerics is challenging the claim that Christians are being singled out because of their faith. even as the UK, the US and international rights groups are pressing Nigeria to take action. Sheikh Ahmed Gumi has negotiated directly with armed bandit groups, arguing that dialogue and even amnesty, rather than military force, offers the best hope of reducing the violence. Critics say those talks merely embolden criminals. Supporters argue they may save lives. I spoke earlier to Sheikh Ahmed Gumi, and I began by asking him if Christians are under attack in his country.
It's unfortunate that the Muslims usually don't count their dead. Otherwise, this same year, just a few months ago, a mosque was ravaged and many Muslims were killed in the mosque too. So it's happening everywhere. I think we have to really separate the chaff from the grain and really understand this complex issue. We have terror, which is has a religious ideology, and we have hearts men who are, if you go on their side and put on their shoes, you see they are fighting to an existential war, because for centuries they depend on cattle rearing, and now the land is shrinking. They are also attacked, you know, when they go into people's farm, and there are clashes. Farmer had their clashes. It's an old clash conflict which is known everywhere in the world. If you say the people who are targeting Christians, the same people targeting Muslims, I wouldn't argue with you about that.
You've said some controversial things, of course, Sheikh, about how the government and how banks, for example, should respond to those who have engaged in kidnapping, sometimes described in Nigeria as bandits, how they should be dealt with. You've suggested that they should be paid, haven't you?
No, I didn't suggest they should be paid at all. What I'm suggesting is that, look, when you go onto their own side, which I have done, there are people fighting, saying they have grievances and they are trying to survive. So I think instead of continual bloodshed, we can sit down.
Let's get some clarity then. You have accompanied government officials to meet with some of these kidnappers.
Yes.
Are you opposed to paying ransoms to these kidnappers?
I'm opposed to paying ransoms since these people are coming themselves ready to give their weapons and drop the issue. All they want is an amnesty so that they cannot be arrested afterwards. You see, the herdsmen are usually uneducated, so they don't have a mouthpiece. Nobody speaks for them. And so if we want to stop this mayhem, is somebody who really goes in there, speak with them, understand them, then he can bring up their story so that the nation will look at it and see how we can come to a peaceful reconciliation of the issue. I, being a medical doctor, being an army officer in Nigeria, being an Islamic cleric, and in the eye of the storm, I cannot just fold my arms. I have to diagnose and see what is actually happening. Is it a case of just pure criminality, or is there any grievances behind it? I took the government together with me to meet these people. So I don't want my area to be a theater of war. If reconciliation can bring peace, then this is what we want. We want peace. We want progress. People are not farming. People are killed. And I think now the government is understanding the complexity and taking the right step. The attacks getting lower and lower. The killings are getting lower and lower. So this is the time the international community should help us to see that we abet this fire.
What does Islamic jurisprudence tell us about the appropriateness or inappropriateness of amnesties in respect of criminality, banditry and kidnappings?
Okay, you see, Islam is very categoric. If there is a communal clash, so what they said is all casualties. In fact, they used the word hadar. Yeah, I mean, it's not liable to be compensated if it's communal. But if it's individual crime, a murderer, a killer, then it's what we call qisas. Such person should be killed as he killed other person. So it depends. What we are having in Nigeria is not just individuals killing individuals. It's a communal clash. There was a Nigerian civil war. More than 2 million people died. Ojukwu, the main instigator of the secession that led to the war, was pardoned by Nigeria after all the death. And that pardon has brought peace to Nigeria. The same thing now with the herdsmen. If we can do something like that, we'll then bring out a program of education and reorientation.
I can understand how you could say, let's have a social and economic intervention in some of these areas if there has been inequality over the years.
And yes, there have been.
If there have been resource distribution issues and treat people fairly. I can understand that, but you're going further than that. You're saying, let's have an amnesty for people who have taken part in organized groups targeting children in schools killing and engaging in kidnapping for money. Why would you, as an Islamic cleric, want to give an amnesty to that person or that group?
Okay, let me tell you why. Because I know for the next 20 years, we cannot finish them. Just Boko Haram. They are smaller in number. 16 years now, we're fighting them. So if they are ready, look at this condition. If they are ready to lay down their arms, which they are, and I can testify, which is better for us, to continue fighting these people for another 20 years where we have more and more casualties from both sides, or to calm down since they are ready to lay down their arms with the condition of an amnesty, which one is easier and better for us? I think I could leave that choice to people who are listening.
Sheikh Ahmed Gumi, bringing an end to this week's edition of Sunday. You can get in touch, of course, on the email sunday@bbc.co.uk. We'll see you next week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Sunday was produced by Baharatu Ibrahim and Katie Booth. Now the vicar of St Martin in the Fields, the Reverend Dr Sam Wells, launches this year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal for the work of St Martin in the Fields charity.
I wonder what Christmas means to you. Warmth, friendship, hope, safety, family, belonging. Perhaps one thing above all, home. Imagine Christmas without these things. No home, instead temporary accommodation, sleeping rough, every door shut, nowhere to go. You're isolated, cold, alone, outside, frightened, it's so hard. Hard to stay healthy, hard to sustain relationships, hard to build emotional stability or find work. For 99 years, the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal has supported St Martin the Fields charity to help people find a safe place to call home. A home at Christmas, a home every day. For people facing crisis, we want the warmth, belonging and security we each seek at Christmas to become the reality all year round. Our emergency grants help people across the UK access new accommodation or avoid losing their home. We support thousands of frontline workers to build relationships with people who've lost trust and hope. In Scotland, we're helping those facing mental health struggles. In Wales, we're supporting vulnerable young people. And in central London, where rough sleeping is at record levels, the connection at St Martin in the Fields supports people to get the healthcare they need and find a settled life away from the streets. Gary was homeless after his relationship broke down. He moved around, staying in temporary accommodation. With an emergency grant from St Martin's, he got a permanent home. He's looking forward to spending Christmas there with his family. This Christmas, you can turn isolation, fear and homelessness into warmth, security and belonging. You can do it today. You can help a person experiencing homelessness access or keep a home and find a new future. Please give generously to the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields. You can make your gift right now by calling 0800 082 8284. That's 0800 082 8284. You can give via the Radio 4 Christmas Appeal website. You can write a cheque to St Martin in the Fields Christmas Appeal. Address your envelope, Free Post St Martin's Christmas Appeal. It will reach us. That simple address, Free Post St Martin's Christmas Appeal. Many of you across the UK have supported us before. We're truly grateful. Today, I'm asking again. The isolation and fear of being without a home are a major challenge, but we can confront it together. I'll tell you what Christmas means to me this year. That a person facing homelessness can find the warmth, security and belonging of home through the support of someone like you. Thank you.
The Reverend Dr. Sam Wells. Calls are free from landlines and mobiles. You can give online, search for Radio 4 Christmas Appeal. If you're a UK taxpayer and you want the charity to collect gift aid on your donation, include an email or postal address. And later this morning, you can hear about some of the lives changed by your donations when Hugh Dennis presents Making a Difference at 9:45. Time for a look at the weather now with Elizabeth Rattini.
Well, thank you, Richard. Good morning. A big contrast in temperatures this morning. Very mild in the southwest, but we've seen a touch of frost across northeastern Scotland, and there will be mixed fortunes for many of us today as well. But most of us are likely to see some rain, band of rain pushing northwards and eastwards, and the winds are set to pick up as well. So the rain already across parts of South Wales, southern England and Northern Ireland. It's cloudy, it's mild here, some hill and some coastal fog around as well. For Scotland and Northern England, East Anglia, then there are some brighter skies this morning. It's been a chillier start here. We'll be seeing the rain across eastern England, central Scotland, probably through the early to mid part of the afternoon. And some of the rain is likely to be heavy at times throughout the day, especially for northwest England, Northern Ireland and North Wales. For the far southwest of England and Wales, though, the rain is set to clear later on. There should be some afternoon brightness by the time we get to sundown. But for northern Scotland and the Northern Isles, it should stay dry for much of the day. Again, some brightness through the morning, and then cloud amounts will increase later. Brisk southeasterly and then southwesterly winds, near gale force actually for the south coast, for the Channel Islands and indeed the Irish Sea coast through the afternoon. Very mild today. Scotland and Northern Ireland, 7 to 12 degrees Celsius. 12 to 15 degrees though for England and Wales. Tonight the rain will continue for a time for central and northern Scotland. Elsewhere some clear spells and a band of showers pushing eastwards from northwest England. Richard.
It's Sunday here on Radio 4, which means at 9 o'clock it's Broadcasting House with Paddy O'Connell.
I warn you, I've just had a posh instant coffee.
Oh really?
I'm full of pep.
Stand by.
I'm worried there's too much coffee fetishism, and I'm thinking we should go back to instant, Richard. Now, is that what I'm meant to be doing in this trial?
No. What's on the programme?
OK, well, books created by artificial intelligence could make it onto shelves. We've created some. We'll ask you to judge. Is it as excruciating as it sounds? We profile Lando Norris, the British Formula One racing driver. The Sundays have bad reading for Labour. Our reviewers are John Lloyd and Daisy McAndrew. And we'll begin with a Ukraine meeting planned in London tomorrow. Join us in an hour.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 7th of December. Good morning, this is Tina Ritchie. Ministers are announcing measures to reduce youth unemployment by offering thousands of construction and hospitality jobs. At least 25 people have been killed in a nightclub fire in western India. The people of Hong Kong are voting in elections amid public anger at one of the deadliest fires there for a decade. Thousands of guaranteed jobs in sectors such as construction and hospitality are to be offered to young people on benefits as part of an £800 million government package to tackle rising youth unemployment. The measure will also offer training and job interviews to try to shift claimants into work. Those who fail to engage with the scheme could see benefit payments cut. Our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
There are almost a million young people in the UK who are not in education, employment or training, and the number is rising. This funding, the government says, will mean 350,000 on universal credit will get training and exposure to work in construction, hospitality and health and social care to break down barriers to employment. Others will get intensive support to help them find jobs and, starting in the spring, 55,000 government-backed guaranteed jobs will start to be made available. The Work and Pension Secretary Pat McFadden described it as an attempt to create real pathways into good jobs. But the government says those who don't engage with the support without good reason could face unspecified sanctions to their benefits. The Conservatives said tax rises implemented by the Chancellor were driving up youth unemployment, and the government was taking with one hand to give back with the other.
At least 25 people have been killed and around 50 injured in a fire at a nightclub in the western Indian state of Goa. The majority of the victims are thought to be staff at the club's kitchen, but tourists are among the dead. The fire is believed to have been triggered by an exploding gas cylinder. The BBC's Vikas Pandey is at the scene.
One eyewitness who was just outside on the road here told us that he heard a lot of screaming and shouting and people rushing out of the club. And when he reached the gate, he saw one of the buildings had turned into a complete fireball, and it was total mayhem after that. Now, this morning, what we're hearing that all the bodies have been moved to Goa Medical College, where the difficult process of identifying them will begin now.
West Midlands Police says one of its senior officers never intended to imply that members of the Jewish community supported the banning of fans from the Israeli club Maccabi Tel Aviv from a match against Aston Villa. The decision not to allow Israeli supporters to attend the Europa League game last month sparked a row. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
Senior police officers from the West Midlands faced questioning from the Cross-Party Home Affairs Committee last Monday about their role in the controversial decision to ban away supporters on safety grounds. Ultimately, Maccabi Tel Aviv didn't take up its ticket allocation. The Assistant Chief Constable, Mike O'Hara, said there were a range of faiths, backgrounds and ethnicities that were very concerned about the fixture. When he was asked by the chair of the committee, Karen Bradley, if that included Jewish people, he said yes, and that this had been documented in a community impact assessment. But the force has now said that in answering these questions, it was never the intention to imply that there were members of the local Jewish community who backed the fans' exclusion. The Sunday Times has reported that Mr O'Hara has now written to representatives of the community in Birmingham to apologise.
The US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth has described American attacks on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Pacific and the Caribbean as righteous, and he likened drug smugglers to terrorists. Mr. Hegseth has faced criticism for the way the airstrikes have been carried out, but he told defence industry leaders in California the world was seeing America's strength of resolve to stop the drug gangs.
We are tracking them, we are killing them. And we will keep killing them so long as they are poisoning our people with narcotics so lethal that they're tantamount to chemical weapons.
Voting is taking place for elections in Hong Kong, where there's anger about one of the deadliest fires in the city in decades. Some pro-democracy politicians have been jailed, while others have fled the territory since China introduced a sweeping security law 5 years ago. From Hong Kong, Danny Vincent reports.
This is only the second Legislative Council election since the system was overhauled in 2021 by the authorities. Under the rules, only people deemed patriots are allowed to stand and candidates are vetted. Critics say Hong Kong has suffered an erosion of freedoms since a wide-ranging national security law was introduced in 2020. The poll is taking place 11 days after a fire at a block of flats killed 159 people, prompting questions about how the blaze spread so quickly and some public anger. The vote is being seen by many as a test of confidence in the authorities, with the turnout likely to come under particular scrutiny.
The German Chancellor Friedrich Merz will meet the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem this morning to discuss the next stage in the US peace plan for Gaza. The first phase agreed a ceasefire and the return of hostages held by Hamas. The remains of one hostage have yet to be returned. From Jerusalem, our correspondent James Cook reports.
Painfully aware of the dark shadow cast by the Holocaust, modern Germany has been a staunch ally of Israel. But relations have been strained recently by the war in Gaza. Friedrich Merz's first trip here as Chancellor comes 2 months after an unsteady ceasefire came into effect as part of a US-led peace plan. After talks in Jordan, Mr. Merz called for Hamas to lay down its arms, more aid for Gaza, and a clear path to Palestinian statehood. His meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu is likely to focus on the next stage of the peace plan. Under a so-called Board of Peace, headed by President Trump, this is supposed to include an international security force in Gaza, a new governing authority, the disarmament of Hamas, and Israel's eventual withdrawal from the territory.
Vets in Northern Ireland are investigating a second suspected case of blue tongue virus in County Down. A new temporary control zone restricting the movement of animals from farms has been introduced around Grey Abbey, 10 miles from where the first case on the island of Ireland was detected a week ago. The disease does not affect humans, but among livestock it can cause ulcers, fever, weight loss and in some cases death. Louise Cullen reports.
After the previous confirmation of more than 40 cases of blue tongue in a herd close to Bangor, this latest detection has come as no surprise, but is a further blow to farmers in Northern Ireland. It's now thought midge plumes brought the virus to the east coast from Great Britain some months ago. It poses no risk to public health or food safety. The new 20-kilometre control zone overlaps with the existing one. Stormont's Agriculture and Environment Minister has warned he may consider extending the zone to the whole of Northern Ireland to help ease the impact of restrictions on farmers. That will depend on where and when new cases emerge.
Cricket. England are heading towards defeat on the fourth day of the second Ashes test at Brisbane. Resuming on 134 for six, England's captain Ben Stokes helped his side to 227 before he was finally caught by Alex Carey. A short time ago, England were 237 for nine in their second innings, a lead of 60 runs. The King and Queen have chosen their 20th wedding anniversary portrait for their official Christmas card. The photo was taken in April at the British Ambassador's residence in Rome during their state visit to Italy. Now for a look at the Sunday papers. An accusation by senior barristers that the Justice Secretary David Lammy has misrepresented figures about the collapse of rape cases is the lead in the Sunday Times. It's claimed he did this in order to push through the abolition of some jury trials in England and Wales. The paper reports that the Justice Secretary suggested 60% of victims are pulling out of cases because of delays in the court system. But the paper quotes two barristers who say the true statistics show the vast majority of reported rape claims are abandoned before a charge is even brought. The Ministry of Justice said the lawyers' comments were completely misleading. The Sunday Telegraph claims Labour's biggest union backer, Unite, is considering a vote on whether to split from the party. It reports that senior union officials are in talks about whether to call an emergency conference to vote on formal disaffiliation from the party. But a source from Unite has told the BBC that such a conference will not take place. A full-page photo of Keir Starmer is on the front page of The Observer. In an interview with the paper, the Prime Minister insists he will fight on in the role and predicts that the former Labour deputy leader, Angela Rayner, will return to the cabinet. The Sunday Mirror leads with details from a new COVID report, which it says show that schemes developed by Boris Johnson's government cost the taxpayer £10.9 billion in fraud. The paper reports that furlough handouts, bounce back loans and the Eat Out to Help Out scheme were easily abused by scammers. And the Duchess of Sussex's father, Thomas Markle, has told the Mail on Sunday that he still hasn't heard from his daughter as he recovers in hospital. The paper explains that his left leg has been amputated below the knee. Mr. Markle explains to the paper that he wants to see Meghan one last time before he dies. And that's your look at the Sunday papers.
That was Tina Ritchie. The novelist, poet, critic and inventor Margaret Atwood is Lauren Laverne's castaway on Desert Island Discs this morning. You can hear some of her favourite music at 10 o'clock. Now, though, on Radio 4 Sunday Worship, which today comes from Swansea. Continuing the theme of Advent authors, today the focus is on Dylan Thomas. The service is led by Father Matthew Roche Saunders, a Catholic priest working across Wales and Herefordshire in youth mission. The service begins with the hymn, Lo, He Comes with Clouds Descending.
Good morning and welcome to Sunday Worship on this second Sunday in Advent. This season of the Church's year is very brief, so it's wonderful to take these moments of prayer and reflection together, to press pause and intentionally to look forward to the birth of Jesus Christ. This season is also an opportunity to reflect on what Christmas means to us, to the world around us, and to some of our great writers from each of our four nations. Today, I'm in an Edwardian suburban house at number 5 Cwmdonkin Drive in Swansea. It's the birthplace of Dylan Thomas, poet and master of comic prose, as in his Child's Christmas in Wales. In this Sunday worship, I'll be talking to one of the guides at this house about Dylan's less well-known religious leanings. I'll also be talking to students at a local Catholic comprehensive school about what they make of Christmas and Dylan Thomas's version of it. Let's take a moment in prayer to begin, borrowing words from the Mass of today. O people of Zion, behold, the Lord will come to save the nations, and the Lord will make the glory of his voice heard in the joy of your heart. Almighty and merciful God, may no earthly undertaking hinder those who set out in haste to meet your Son, but may our learning of heavenly wisdom gain us admittance to his company, who lives and reigns for ever and ever. Amen. Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales celebrates one aspect we might associate with this time of year, a scene of gently falling snow and a time of warm exchanges of presents and stories. He says this:
One Christmas was so much like the other. In the years around the sea town corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6.
That extract was read for us by Welsh children's poet Alex Wharton. Dylan Thomas wrote those nostalgic words around 1945, at a time of global horror. Bombs, atrocities, senseless deaths. No wonder he invited his readers to reminisce about more innocent times. Times before Swansea itself was decimated by a blitz, marks of which can even today be seen on certain walls. We might well hold Thomas's image of White Christmas in stark contrast to the war taking place around him. However, Christians believe that it was exactly because of the brokenness of our world that God enters human history in the little child born in Bethlehem. He himself is the peace that the world craves so much. His entrance into the world is the dawn of salvation. We look to that dawning hope in our hymn, Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence.
Yeah.
All the Christmases roll down towards the two-tongued sea, like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find.
Looking through the windows, I can start to appreciate what Dylan Thomas meant by the two-tongued sea, the expanse of Swansea Bay, and the delight he may have felt in the innocent look and feel of snow. It's a far cry from the world in which he actually lived in 1945, when A Child's Christmas in Wales was first commissioned for Children's Hour. The ugly, lovely town, as he described Swansea, was no more. The centre had been obliterated, the familiar streets destroyed by bombs. I'm with one of the guides to the house, Jeff Hayden, Swansea born and bred. Thanks very much for showing us a bit of Dylan Thomas's house.
It's my pleasure to invite you here.
And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your own interest in Dylan Thomas.
Well, I went to Swansea Grammar School, so I knew the word Dylan Thomas when I was an 11-year-old, not really appreciating that he was a famous poet.
Jeff, we're sitting in the front room of Dylan Thomas's house. How long of his life did he spend here in Cwndonkin Drive?
He was here for 23 years, and he wrote two-thirds of his published work while living in the house in his little bedroom upstairs.
Gosh, wow. And I mean, there's much written about Dylan Thomas's drinking exploits, which are legendary, but for this, as we're praying about the second Sunday of Advent, could you speak to us a little bit about his religious views?
I think the drinking is a bit overemphasised. I think he had unconventional religious views, but he had certainly had religious views, and I think that goes back to his very early childhood. Dylan's mother was very, very religious, and she used to take Dylan and his sister Nancy to a chapel every Sunday in Newton, around the coast from here, where her sister Theodosia was married to the minister David Rees.
Wow. Do you see any of that religious upbringing reflected in Dylan Thomas's poetry?
I think it's there. You can see religious involvement all the way through Dylan's poetry. This is the airing cupboard. Dylan describes it, the pipes as rattling and swearing at him and nearly driving him mad.
In fact, Jeff, I can see it written on the door. The hot water pipes are swearing at me.
That's right.
Was that written by Dylan, or has that been written since?
That wasn't written on the door by Dylan. But those are his words.
Wow.
So this is Dylan's little bedroom.
Gosh, it is a very little bedroom.
If you close the door, you can see that we're in a little enclosed space, perfect for concentrating on what you're doing.
I can see on this desk here, Jeff, pictures and bits of paper crunched up underneath. There's sweets, there's a packet of cigarettes, some chocolate. It looks like he's just got up from the desk.
Well, that's what we hope to achieve.
Strike in the time bomb town, raise the live rafters of the eardrum, throw your fear a parcel of stone through the dark asylum, lapped among Herod's wail, as their blade marches in, that the eyes are already murdered, the stocked heart is forced, and agony has another mouth to feed.
The innocent age was no more. Those lines from a poem, A Saint About to Fall, are difficult, but they seem to speak to this understanding of a broken world. I wonder where else we can think of examples of brokenness around us. It's sometimes simpler, and much more attractive, to retreat to an ideal version of childhood, a time before struggles, a time before brokenness. As we hear our first reading from the prophet Isaiah, we hear the same desire, to reset the world to a more innocent age. But interestingly, he speaks in the future tense, not looking back in nostalgia.
The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. In that day the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire, and the resting place shall be glorious.
It's hard to imagine wolves lying with lambs, leopards lying with kids. Isaiah whispers hope into the context he lived in, of waiting for a child, a Messiah, someone innocent of all danger who would share that reality with others. I've come to Bishop Vaughan School, a Catholic comprehensive in Swansea. I want to hear from the students what they make not only of this season of Advent, but also of Swansea's, and maybe Wales's, most famous writer.
During Advent, before Christmas, I noticed that people go shopping, they go around to get physical decorations for their houses. But I think the most important thing about Advent is decorating our hearts to ensure that Christ Jesus comes to us on Christmas Day.
Ria, that's a really interesting idea about decorating the heart. I wonder if you can say, how do you prepare to decorate the heart in Advent?
I think we should take time in prayer and reflect on the year to see what we have done. Have we been kind towards others? Have we been prayerful? Have we been looking after others? Have we been living the values by Jesus?
I wonder, what does it mean to you that Jesus comes at Christmas? What does it mean that God is born as a child at Christmas, as a human? What does that mean for our human experience?
I think it serves as a reminder of what he was willing to do for us since the fall of man. The birth of Jesus is God's gift to us, and the reminder that he's still here, that he still cares, even if sometimes it doesn't seem like it.
And you use the word in what you just said, you use the word gift, that the coming of God is a gift. And it's a word that Dylan Thomas uses in his story, A Child's Christmas in Wales. Why is it that the coming of God is a gift to us? What does that mean for God to be a gift, for Jesus Christ to be a gift?
I feel like it's a gift because after the fall of man, according to God's justice, we really don't deserve anything. And for God to give us that Christ Jesus for salvation, I feel like it is a gift, an undeserving gift.
So the fact that God has become man in Jesus Christ means he's lived the same age that you are. You're in high school, so Jesus lived the same age as you. Have you ever thought about that? Is that something that helps your prayer?
I think it's really relatable because at the age of like 13, turning 14, you feel like really sometimes hopeless in your faith. But when you think that Jesus is at your age, you think like, oh, Jesus was my age. Though the time was like different, he may have combated the same battles that we fight with our faith, or like the battles that we fight with our parents or with our friends.
When you read A Child's Christmas in Wales, does that strike a chord with you in 2025? Dylan Thomas is writing 70 years ago, and he's remembering even then a time that's more like 100 years ago from now. Does that still strike a chord to you today in modern Wales?
I think that although times then were very different to now, now we've gone into more of a sort of consumerism society, I think all of the key messages still remain. They all gather around to enjoy good food, good music, good company together. And those key messages of the Catholic faith in Christmas are still prominent, like the messages of love and kindness and hope for salvation, for the future. The messages of charity and togetherness are still very prominent in Dylan Thomas's work.
They were the useful presents, engulfing mufflers of the old coach days and mittens made for giant sloths, zebra scarfs of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-of-war down to the galoshes, blinding tam-o-shanters like patchwork tea cozies and bunny-suited busbies and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tribes. and pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles's pond and did, and drowned. And books that told me everything about the wasp, except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-coloured jelly babies, and a folded flag, and a false nose, and a tram conductor's cap. And a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell, never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet, hard-boiled toffee, fudge and all sorts, crunches, cracknels, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan and butter Welsh for the Welsh, and troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run, and snakes and families and happy ladders, and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions, oh, easy for Leonardo, and a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth, and you stood at the corner of the street, and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette. And then, with a smirk, you ate it. And then it was breakfast under the balloons.
As crass as the question might sound, into which of these categories would we put the greatest gift ever received by this world, the Christ child himself? Useful? The presence of God himself coming to save us is hardly useful in the sense of a hand-knitted scarf or a woolen vest. And there again, Thomas makes the useless presents sound much more fun. Marzipan, games, gadgets. And as Christians, we believe coming to know Jesus is the greatest joy imaginable in this life and in the next. The choir of Bishop Vaughan School will now sing Light of the World by Lauren Daigle, God with Us.
The world waits for a miracle. The heart longs for a little bit of hope. Oh come, Emmanuel. Child prays for peace on earth, and she's calling now from a sea of fur. Oh come, Emmanuel. And can you hear the angels sing? Drought breaks with the tears of a mother. A baby's cry is the sound of love. Come down, Emmanuel.
He's the sole of the suffering. He's Messiah, the Prince of Peace. Has come, Emmanuel. Oh, Emmanuel.
We come now to our Gospel reading, taken from Matthew chapter 3, verses 1 to 12.
In those days, John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judea, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." For this is he who was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah, when he said, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight." Now John wore a garment of camel's hair and a leather belt around his waist, and his food was locusts and wild honey. Then Jerusalem and all Judea and all the region about the Jordan were going out to him, and they were baptized by him in the river Jordan, confessing their sins. But when he saw many of the Pharisees and the Sadducees coming to his baptism, he said to them, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bear fruit in keeping with repentance, and do not presume to say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our father,' for I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children for Abraham. Even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. I baptize you with water for repentance, but he who is coming after me is mightier than I, whose sandals I am not worthy to carry. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fork is in his hand, and he will clear his threshing floor and gather his wheat into the barn, but the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire."
In our Old Testament reading, we were placed in a world of restored peace that's hard to imagine, with predators relaxing next to their prey, images as arresting as those of Dylan Thomas. It's the gift of our greatest poets and writers to lead our imaginations into a transcendent reality. If this were not attainable, the author's work would be a complete fiction, a mirage, which when faced with the actual reality on our TV screens, in our newspapers, and perhaps even closer to home, disappears as a phantom. Maybe this malaise influences the way many of us might approach the pages of Scripture, not as a definite promise of a world that will look like that, but rather as just another poem that's pleasant to read, but ultimately another child's story that is destroyed by the ways of the world. This malaise needs to be shaken up sometimes, to remember that the brokenness for which we have so much evidence is not the norm. It isn't how the Master has intended it, and it isn't how the Master has left it, but rather that he himself is the offering that puts everything right. Characters such as the one we meet in our Gospel reading can help us with this. However unusual his clothing and his diet, John the Baptist is a man of absolute conviction. Conviction shakes up the way we see the world. Oftentimes it isn't the words of a carefully crafted talk or sermon that touch us most deeply, but rather the personal testimony of someone who speaks of what God has done in their lives. John is such a one. He allows the clarity of his belief in the coming Messiah to influence his whole manner of being. He condemns the religiosity of the leaders at the time, which obscured the simplicity of the Christ child. He is unwilling to see the brokenness around him as the norm, and he invites us to hope that there is an end to the violence, mistrust, abuse, and neglect that we see around us. In a word, the sin of the world, and mine, and yours. Jesus Christ is himself the medicine and the healing for a world exhausted by its sinfulness. In A Child's Christmas in Wales, Dylan Thomas uses childhood as a motif for how we might relate to the world around us, with tired eyes refreshed by a new season of hope in our lives. Here are a few words in which we can almost taste the joy, the innocence, and the cheekiness of this conversation.
I would go out, my bright new boots squeaking, into the white world, onto the seaward hill to call on Jim and Dan and Jack, and to pad through the still streets, leaving huge, deep footprints on the hidden pavements. I bet people will think they've been hippos. What would you do if you saw a hippo coming down our street? I'd go like this. Bang! I'd throw him over the railings and roll him down the hill, and then I'd tickle him under the ear and he'd wag his tail. What would you do if you saw two hippos, iron-flanked and bellowing he-hippos, clanked and battered through the scudding snow towards us as we passed Mr. Daniel's house? Let's post Mr. Daniel a snowball through his letterbox. Let's write things in the snow. Let's write, Mr. Daniel looks like a spaniel all over his lawn.
We hear our next hymn, On Jordan's Bank the Baptists Cry, imagining ourselves as those standing around hearing this first proclamation of the Messiah and startled by the freshness of the Baptist's conviction. Dullan Thomas, a consummate wordsmith, specialises in creating an impression in his readers by the way the words fall. I remember a friend telling me that the correct way to read poetry, if there is such a thing, is to ask, how has this made me feel? What's the mark these words are making inside me? What a remarkable reflection this is, that the gift of human language is not simply the communication of facts and figures from one mind to another, which is amazing already, but the invisible conjuring of dreams, images, hopes, words are fundamental to our communication. As well as being an historical Messiah who restores peace, the Lord who is a lamb approaching the lion of our brokenness, Jesus Christ is described in his essence in the Gospel of John. He begins, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Before all time, before any created thing, before our attempts to communicate with one another, the whole fabric of our existence was founded in one who is Word. In Greek, the use of logos expresses even more: pattern, reason, logic. God the Word, God the Logos, who takes flesh in the person of Jesus of Nazareth, is himself what it is to communicate perfectly. He contains within himself the fulfillment of every desire I have to communicate myself. That longing to be understood by another, for the Christian, that is Jesus. This is breathtaking. Poets, writers, artists, they each seek to communicate something in part, which Jesus of Nazareth doesn't only communicate better, but rather is the very centre of reason, at the heart of all created matter. As we open our hearts to welcome a Saviour who is so fundamental to the world's existence and is the child crying in his mother's arms, let's hear some final thoughts of Dullan Thomas, who speaks precisely of the power of the Word.
In the beginning was the Word, that from the solid bases of light abstracted all the letters of the void, and from the cloudy bases of the breath the Word flowed up, translating to the heart first characters of birth and death.
We come now to our prayers of intercession, and I'm joined once again by the children of Bishop Vaughan School in Swansea.
We pray for our world, which we love so much, and yet is torn apart by the decisions of human hearts to fight, to kill, to spread hate, to destroy. We pray for those who are most affected by the hurt done to our world, especially through war or through natural disasters. We pray that all human hearts would choose peace in their everyday lives. Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
As we reflect on the work of Dylan Thomas, we give thanks for the work of poets and writers who have sought to use language to restore hope, to bring about peace, and to long for restored innocence. May we know the power of the Word himself, Jesus Christ, hidden in every page of the Scriptures, and come to base our lives on the truth of his saving power. Christ, have mercy.
Christ, have mercy.
We pray for our society as we prepare to remember the birth of Jesus Christ this Christmas. May we be awoken from our expectation of brokenness and be willing to be surprised by one who is himself good news for the world. Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
We join all our prayers, spoken and unspoken, in the prayer that Jesus himself taught us to pray. Our Father, who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
We hear now our final hymn, Come Thou Long-Expected Jesus. Now for the blessing. May the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit come down upon you this day and remain with you forever. Amen.
Sunday worship was led by Father Matthew Roche Saunders, Director of Youth Mission in the Archdiocese of Cardiff-Menevia. The programme was produced by Jeff Ballinger. Next week in Sunday worship, Rachel Mann will be at Lyme Park in Cheshire, exploring Advent and Jane Austen. Talking of which...
I had found a writer who was unlike anything I had ever encountered. It was like suddenly encountering dynamite.
Celebrating the life and work of Jane Austen.
From 15 to 17, she was in training for a heroine.
With Catherine Rundle, Gurinder Chadha, David Baddiel and more.
Jane Austen is possibly the greatest storyteller in English literature, so I'm always going to love her.
A special selection of documentaries and drama.
250 years of Jane Austen. on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. And as part of our Jane Austen celebration, you can hear the first of a new two-part dramatisation of Pride and Prejudice starring Tamsin Gregg on Saturday afternoon at 3:15, or you can listen now on BBC Sounds. Now, on Radio 4, Witness History takes you back to 1971 and one of the greatest hoaxes in literary history, a fake autobiography of the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes.
I don't really know deep down why I did it. Undoubtedly some streak of lunacy, a screw loose somewhere, spirit of adventure, greed, the literary challenge involved, middle-aged boredom, a whole combination of things. It's a lot easier after the event to analyze why you did what you did, but generally you're wrong.
That's Clifford Irving, an American writer and convicted con man, trying to explain to the BBC in 1977 why he engineered a swindle that almost fooled the world.
I thought, wouldn't it be a fantastic idea to take a character like Hughes, who has done so much and yet is so secretive, men who people think they know a lot about, but they really know very little, and do a fictionalized biography of him, which would purport to be real.
Irving's plan was made easier by the man supposedly at the centre of the book, Howard Hughes. Hughes was an aerospace engineer, film producer, record-breaking aviator and business tycoon who built a $2 billion fortune to become one of the richest people in the world. But he was also a bit of a loner.
Pictures of the elusive millionaire has not been photographed since 1957.
None of Hughes' top executives have seen him in the last 4 years.
Hughes moved away from Houston 50 years ago, and none had seen him in years.
And by the 1960s, he was living as a recluse, reportedly in darkened rooms, naked, eating little and refusing to cut his nails. So terrified of catching a disease that he had almost no contact with the outside world. There were even doubts he was still alive.
It's one of the ironies of the Howard Hughes saga that his very unwillingness to be seen in public specifically draws attention to wherever he is and whoever is near him.
So when the publisher McGraw-Hill announced that Clifford Irving had persuaded the billionaire to tell his story, there was huge interest.
He was there, like Mount Everest, to be climbed. He was inaccessible. No one had interviewed him in the last 20 years, and he could not step forward in public. And he was a fascinating man.
Irving set to work on the fake manuscript, helped by his friend, another American author, Richard Susskind, and a $750,000 advance from the publishers, as he told the BBC's Ian Johnston.
Well, we did an awful lot of hard research. We travelled back and forth across the United States and wherever we could, through libraries, newspaper files, to get information on Hughes. We amassed a huge amount of data. We had access to Time Life's secret files, which were excellent. On top of that, we were both novelists, and we let our imaginations run amok. We had Hughes going to Ethiopia as a bush pilot to get back among the common people, visiting Albert Schweitzer down in French Equatorial Africa in search of a guru, palling around with Ernest Hemingway in Cuba, fishing, skinny dipping together. We created a portrait of the billionaire in search of his soul, which was a hell of a damn sight more exciting, I think, than Howard Hughes' life.
You've created a madman. He thinks everybody wants to kill him. He rakes his peas with a silver rake, only eating the smallest that get through. He watches television through a lead grass screen to prevent gamma rays getting at him. He won't shake hands with people who have diseases. How did this man come about?
Most of the details you've mentioned are based on purported fact. His aversion to germs is well known and very well documented. We certainly elaborated on them, but we felt that was more than balanced by the hero we had created, because we had Hughes flying over France in World War II on a special pass from President Roosevelt to do reconnaissance missions.
Which he never did.
Of course he never did it.
And between Irving and Susskind, dreaming up these lies was simple.
I sat down, put a tape recorder going. I said, I've got a hangover today. You be Howard, I'll be Clifford. And after a while, when that turned stale, we'd switch roles. And then we edited the tapes, erased them, because we didn't want them to fall in the hands of anybody else. And then after it was all typed and transcribed, we edited it to make it even more interesting.
But you must have envisaged that Hughes himself would make a denial.
Well, we envisaged so little that it was pitiful. I mean, we were babes in the woods. We didn't think that the Hughes people would find out unless somebody leaked it to the media.
But Hughes did find out, and he wasn't happy. Early in 1972, he broke 7 years of silence at a televised press conference.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hughes.
Good afternoon to you, Mr. Neal. Oh, I hear you well.
But Hughes didn't face the journalists in person. He was on the phone from his hideaway in the Bahamas, his voice on a speaker.
My question is this. Did you cooperate or do you know a man named Irving who claims to have taped this biography with you?
Well, I only wish I was still in the movie business because I don't remember any script as wild as this yarn has turned out to be. This episode is just so fantastic that it taxes your imagination.
I take it, sir, you do not know a man named Clifford Irving, then?
No, I never saw him. I never even heard of him.
But Irving remained defiant. He insisted the voice on the phone was false, and he could prove it. He claimed to have letters from Hughes himself, confirming the deal. But like the book, they were not exactly authentic.
I simply knocked out a letter, or three letters, in fact, from Hughes to me, approximating what I thought his handwriting would look like, and I gave them to McGraw-Hill. They were on yellow-lined paper. And apparently that's all you need to do to write. If you want to write a letter from Howard Hughes, just write it on yellow-lined paper and everyone seems to accept that it's from Hughes.
But the scam was falling apart. A recording of the press conference was sent to a voice expert.
From the result of our analysis this afternoon, it would be my opinion that it indeed was Howard Hughes' voice. It's as close to 100% as I, as a scientist, would want to go.
And then it was revealed that the $750,000 cheque given to Irving for Hughes had been cashed in Switzerland by a woman, Clifford Irving's wife.
Edith Irving had disguised herself in a black wig and opened an account at the Swiss Credit Bank in Geneva in the name of Helga R. Hughes. Her troubles increased when two ladies testified that when Irving had said that he had been meeting Howard Hughes, he had in fact been enjoying romantic interludes with them.
Irving's hoax and his marriage were finally over.
At first it was a lark, and then we realized we were getting in deeper, and it was a crime, and there were criminal acts involved. And we not only hoped to get away with it, we talked ourselves into the absolute necessity of getting away with it, because we realized toward the end that jail was in the offing if we failed.
The federal charge to which the Irvings had pleaded guilty was conspiracy to swindle the McGraw-Hill Publishing Company of $750,000. For that, Clifford Irving today was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. Mrs. Irving will serve 60 days in jail.
So did Irving see himself as a con man?
No, certainly not. I did it once. I'll never do it again, I hope. I mean, if a man goes out and gets drunk once, you don't call him a drunkard. It was something I wanted to do. There was a big lie involved. Not something I'm proud of. I did have to lie to a few friends of mine because I couldn't very well take them into my confidence and involve them. And I regret it.
Irving served 17 months of his sentence and was greeted by the press on his release.
Prison was a nice place to visit, but I don't want to live there.
Do you owe anybody any money at this point?
Yes, I owe a total of about just under $1 million to the IRS, to McGraw-Hill, and to my various attorneys. Well,
how do you think you're going to pay that off, or are you?
Slowly.
Witness History was presented and produced by Jane Wilkinson. For more memorable moments from history told by people who were there, search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. This is Radio 4. Now, a moment to appreciate the starling in today's Tweet of the Day with the poet Paul Farley. The programme's produced by Sophie Anton.
Starlings are rightly admired for their winter displays, when they gather in their thousands to swarm and shapeshift in our twilight skies. But looked at individually and in close-up, they're just as impressive. Every spring, a pair used to nest in a hollow breeze-block wall in the house where I grew up, and I never tired of studying their plumage. Dark and shiny and iridescent, the stained glass of an oily puddle, fletched with ticks like the arrows on a convict's uniform, sequined and spangled as if the lights of a city at night had caught in their feathers. So it's a dazzling bird, however you encounter it. And the starling is a brilliant mimic too. I used to lie in bed listening to one on our roof that could do a radio being tuned. And they're known for their collages of clicks, dog barks, car alarms, squeaky doors, ringtones, even human voices. We look and listen